You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
It is my great pleasure to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week, Reese Ehrlich. He has been on before. He is an author. He is a journalist. He is currently on book tour around the United States. You find the schedule at reeseehrlich.com. And the paperback version of his book has just come out, Inside Syria, the backstory of their civil war and what the world can expect. Reese Ehrlich, welcome back to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you very much for having me.
So the United States has accidentally, intentionally bombed the troops of a government it's trying to overthrow. Worst bit of luck it's had in weeks. Can you give us some of the backstory on what has just happened in Syria?
Well, the official version is that the United States accidentally bombed a Syrian military base near Deir ez-Zor, which is in the eastern part of Syria. It's a city I've traveled to a couple times in the past, and it is a city near which the Islamic State has control. The problem with the U.S. version is that so far, if it was genuinely an accident, and the U.S. wanted to maintain the continued ceasefire, I would have expected a much more heartfelt apology from Secretary of State John Kerry and others. Instead, we get this bellicose rhetoric blaming Assad for his bombing and failure to deliver the relief supplies to besieged cities, and in general trying to shift the blame to the Assad forces and to Russia. It just doesn't make sense politically to do that if it was really an accident.
I'm not saying you're wrong, Reese, but how many times has the U.S. government apologized in recent years and decades for bombing people? I know they just gave $1 million to the family of an Italian victim, but they don't do that for Middle Eastern victims. Are you sure they don't just have a policy of not apologizing?
Well, ultimately, the U.S. apologized for shooting down an Iranian airliner in 1988 as well. You're right. In general, at the time, the U.S. It doesn't show much remorse, but they could have, in the political statements afterwards, emphasized the fact that this mistake, while tragic, should not interfere with the ongoing ceasefire. In fact, it looks like it's just going to blow the ceasefire sky high.
And what is the form of this ceasefire to begin with? I mean, it seems to be a ceasefire wherein only certain parties are supposed to cease firing. I mean, what kind of a ceasefire is that to begin with?
Again, officially, roughly a little bit over a week ago, the U.S. and Russia agreed to a ceasefire and a peace offensive, if you will, that was supposed to have the following elements. Everybody that either side controlled would stop shooting. In other words, the Assad regime and its allies, Iran and Hezbollah, the U.S. and whatever rebel groups it controls would stop. And if the ceasefire succeeded for 7 days, then the U.S. and Russia would join together to jointly target Islamic State and al-Nusra, that is the two extremist rebel groups, target their facilities, the cities they control, and so on, in an effort to have a joint cooperation in fighting the extremist groups. The peace plan had serious flaws from the very beginning. A similar one didn't work back in February. And the basic problem is that neither side can agree as to who the extremists are. And secondly, the extremist groups themselves are not bound by the ceasefire, so they're going to attack particularly Assad and try and scuttle the ceasefire.
There was also a story in the news this week of a supposedly U.S.-backed, U.S.-controlled group cursing and shooting at U.S. troops, clearly not a U.S.-controlled group. Who does the U.S. actually control in Syria?
Not very many people. That's the other serious problem. We hear in the U.S. a lot of kind of optimistic talk about the moderate rebels and how you know, the U.S. they support the U.S. and so on. In the Kurdish community, there is cooperation with the U.S., although even that's up for grabs now. But among everyone else, that is Syrian Arabs, the U.S.-backed groups have almost no popular support, and when they do get arms and come into the country from either Jordan or from Turkey, almost immediately they're captured by mostly the al-Nusra forces, and their weapons are seized, and the whole thing blows up in the U.S. face. The U.S. has spent over $1 billion just in the southern front in Jordan and has no rebels of any significant number to show that it's for all that money and effort. And the problem is the U.S. is incredibly unpopular in the Middle East. They're not trusted. People in Syria saw what the U.S. did in Iraq, and they're not interested in having that happen to them. And the result is, even after 4 years of efforts, the U.S. has basically no popular support among Arab Syrians.
It seems that Syria, as well as the rest of the region, is nonetheless full of U.S. weaponry, and there is clear evidence of support over the years and currently from Turkey and from Saudi Arabia for the groups that that the U.S. and Russia seem to consider the worst of the worst, ISIS and others. And does the ceasefire include any sort of arms embargo? Is there any new plan in place to stop saturating the region with weaponry?
The answer to your first question is no. The ceasefire doesn't have anything, put any restrictions on Saudi Arabia or Turkey, for example, nor on Iran and Hezbollah, for that matter,
yeah,
in terms of shipping in arms and so on. The U.S., a little bit of background, and I've been to Turkey several times, as well as northern Iraq, and the border into Syria is porous. And for a long time, at first, the Turks supported the Muslim Brotherhood. When they didn't seem to have much support, they switched over to al-Nusra and the Islamic State. And they know perfectly well that their borders were being used to ship in arms and fighters. I traveled on a plane inside Turkey, and there were Libyan political extremists on board in full beards and Arabic dressed, and they claimed they were doctors helping the Syrians. They were guerrilla fighters. So it's not a secret inside Turkey. The U.S. has put a lot of pressure on Turkey to stop that. The Turks themselves, the Turkish government, realizes that, you know, they've been the subject of several horrendous terrorist bombings inside Turkey, including the Istanbul airport. So I think they have tried harder. But by all indications, the border is still rather porous, and these extremist groups are getting through with or without the support of the Turkish government.
It's not clear what the U.S. policy aims are, never mind Turkey's. The United States, it seems, still wants to overthrow the Syrian government while also wanting to oppose opposition to the Syrian government. And there was stories a couple weeks back where the United States military was talking about defending its troops in Syria against possible Syrian aggression by Syrian troops, which seems to be a way no other nation talks about its occupying armies around the world. And now we have an attack, a defensive attack, presumably on Syrian troops by occupying U.S. troops in Syria, that also has the advantage for certain parties in Washington of, again, increasing hostility with Russia. How much of this is incompetence and how much of it is evil intentions?
Oh, I think there's plenty of both to go around. The U.S. is caught on the horns of a dilemma. Some months into the uprising in 2011, the U.S. called for the overthrow of Assad. That was the U.S. strategy for a number of years. It failed. Assad is still in power. And the after 2014, in the summer, when the Islamic State seized a number of cities in Syria and in Iraq, the U.S. shifted strategies and made defeating the extremist forces the main goal, and getting rid of Assad was the secondary goal. So that meant objectively that the U.S. was not going to try to get rid of Assad as a first priority. And that led to serious breaks with all of the rebel groups, including the ones that had nominally supported the United States, because they still saw Assad as the enemy. And that plays out down to today, where officially the U.S. strategy is to defeat the Islamic State first and then deal with Assad as part of our transition government later down the line. But the examples of U.S. rebels shooting at the U.S. troops would be a reflection of that very, very serious policy difference. If you're in the field, it makes a huge difference. If you're fighting Assad as your main enemy and you'll ally with Nusra and other extremists to achieve your goal. If you're backing U.S. policy, you would not. You would fight against Nusra. And so far, the so-called moderate groups the U.S. is working with have been lining up with Nusra and other extremists against Assad.
Yeah, I remember just some months back now, this summer, a State Department video of a State Department press conference in which the State Department spokesman is asked, just as Syria is about to retake the city of Palmyra, do you want Syria to retake that city or ISIS to maintain it? And the guy couldn't answer. He clearly had not been authorized to give an answer to that, which shocked lots of people who passed it around on Facebook, right? But it seems the U.S. policy has not moved away from, opposing the Syrian government in every way possible.
Well, it's not in every way possible, but clearly the medium long-term goal of the U.S. is to oppose Assad and get rid of him. It's the short-run issue that is the huge problem for the U.S., and it's reflected in that State Department answer, which is they don't want to say they support Assad in retaking territory, but neither do they want to say they're supporting the IS. And it's a political conundrum that you can't square the circle. You've got to have one or the other, and the U.S. Wants to have both.
And now we have what happening at the United Nations as a result of Russia exclaiming that the United States has committed a gross crime and violated the peace and the ceasefire. The U.S. newspapers are telling us the problem here is a Russian diplomatic row, not, you know, the United States bombing people. What is going to come of that?
Well, maybe your listeners can just imagine what would have happened if the Russians had bombed a U.S. base or a Kurdish base in the region. What would the reaction of the U.S. and then afterwards said it was an accident? Oh, my God, it was an act of war for the right wing, and the hawks in the U.S. would call for an immediate end of any cooperation with Russia. How dare they bomb our allies? How dare they claim it was an accident? We want an international neutral investigation into these matters. You know, there'd be a huge hubbub. Of course, because the U.S. did it, it's okay, because we're the good guys and they're the bad guys. I would hope that there could be some kind of an independent investigation. I await the version of what happened coming from the parties involved. I think we're going to find a lot more going on than the U.S. currently admits.
We have just 1 minute left. Rhys Ehrlich, is the United Nations United Nations, or is it a tool of the United States? I mean, ought it not to try to hold the United States accountable for that bombing and for the entire war itself, for that matter?
Well, I agree with you. I think the United States should hold the U.S. Guilty, but that's not likely to happen given the structure of the U.N. The U.N. does do some good things, particularly in the way of humanitarian relief, refugee, health, education, and so on. And I don't knock the U.N. overall. But when it comes to the Security Council and these kinds of issues of peace and war, the Security Council is pretty much useless.
Pretty much useless. A lot of work to be done there. Thank you for the work you're doing and for filling us in. Rhys Ehrlich, catch up with him at rhysehrlich.com. He's on book tour. Rhys, thanks for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Always a pleasure.
I'm very happy to welcome back to Talk Nation Radio Colleen Rowley, a retired FBI agent, former legal counsel who taught law enforcement ethics, and who, of course, was a 9/11 whistleblower. Colleen Rowley, welcome back to Talk Nation Radio.
Hi, David.
Hi, great to hear from you. I have a sore throat. I hope you'll do most of the talking. I want to ask you about the current state of military madness, but first, I understand you have
upcoming award ceremony for the latest recipient of the Sam Adams Award. Can you remind people what that award is and tell us what's coming up?
Yes, Ray McGovern had a colleague way back during the Vietnam War who found that they were, falsifying the intelligence, which, as you well know, is always these lies are always a pretext for war, and also in the case of Sam Adams, for sustaining the Vietnam War when General Westmoreland and the other generals would lie and say they were making progress, even though the Tet Offensive and My Lai massacres and all those things were going on. They would go out to the public and say, we're winning the war in Vietnam. Of course, very sadly, we're at a similar stage right now. So Ray McGovern had this great idea that we would give an award for integrity in intelligence. It's often whistleblowers who have the courage to tell the truth to the public, but not always. Sometimes even there are people who fight the good fight internally, as actually Sam Adams did. And so for 15 years, this will be the 15th annual Sam Adams Award that will be given to former CIA official John Kiriakou, who had the courage to tell the public that the Bush administration was torturing people, long, many years ago now. But what happened afterwards is that he was retaliated against and eventually ended up serving about 2 years in prison as a result. Unfortunately, Voltaire, I think, said this, telling the truth when the government is wrong is a very dangerous job. And it turns out of our 15 awards, at least a couple, three, four of them, including Chelsea Manning, have had to do prison time for their truth telling. Some of the people, I'm in that category. I was very lucky to have much less retaliation than having to go to prison for telling the truth. But anyway, we are tagging along on the World Beyond War's No War 2016 conference. And so if people are at that conference, they can stay a little longer in the K Chapel at American University on September 25th, Sunday, September 25th, beginning at 4. We'll hold our annual award ceremony, this time honoring John Kiriakou for his opposition to torture. Anyway, hope anybody can come. It's free. The public is welcome to attend. The details are on the website, too. And if you go, it's both the Sam Adams Associates for Integrity and Intelligence. We have our own website, and I think it's on the World Beyond War's website as well.
Yes, indeed. The conference is at worldbeyondwar.org. And as we speak, Friday, September 23rd is full to capacity, but people can still register for Saturday and Sunday. With this event Sunday evening, there's actually a little bit more capacity. It's a bigger space than the other events. Hopefully by the time this reaches listeners on radio stations, there will still be room for people to register for Saturday and Sunday at that conference. And of course, a big nonviolent protest action at the Pentagon the next day, the 26th, which may see some more people in legal difficulty in the United States. Colleen Rowley, what do you make of the current state of U.S. militarism abroad and protests of some of the disasters that result back home? We've at RootsAction.org, we've been cheering for Colin Kaepernick and others sitting out the national anthem and protesting racist police violence at home. But then even they conspicuously cheer for the military as if we can go and bomb dark-skinned Muslim countries around the world endlessly for no discernible reason and not have that, not have the bombs land in the ghetto, as Dr. King said, not have the weapons given to the police and the racism come back domestically.
Precisely. And that is exactly why I've been writing this on social media and to my various Google lists, because it is something that, as evidenced even by Colin Kaepernick and the media coverage of his opposition to the police repression of blacks inside the United States. This is really the point that's missing. Even Colin Kaepernick doesn't understand that the violence that has now blown back inside the United States, and it's not just the police reckless shootings of people in the United States. It manifests itself on a variety of levels. But we have an increased violence in the United States, which actually I predicted when I wrote a memo in 2003 on the eve of the Iraq War, just a couple of weeks. I realized that this would be the case, and it's not hard to realize that you would have this blowback of increased domestic terrorism, even inside the United States, but also the senseless mass shootings, the militarization of the police. That was what I actually pointed to in my memo way back in 2003. All of these are forms, they are direct consequences of our militarism abroad. And again, that's why I wanted to talk about this, because even astute observers of the wars don't understand that this is how it works. I had a group that was debating the Hunger Games. So for instance, these fictional plots, and the Hunger Games is just probably the best well-known one, but there are many other movies with the same plot that have this idea that as long as human beings are allowed a spectacle of witnessing this almost in a pornographic way, this worst violence, the Hunger Games is a good example, having the young people have to kill each other in front of an audience. There's this plot that goes, as long as humans can get it out of their system by witnessing horrific wanton violence, that somehow this will help, you know, they'll get it out of their system this way. And I suppose people think that by going to football games and watching some of those spectacles, that somehow this helps in the sense that then we won't need war. Human beings need war because it's in their blood or something like that. So this is exactly the opposite. Certainly fictional writers, you know, it's a fine little thing for them to do, but it's exactly the opposite. When we have a culture that shows us, you know, violent scenes, even in movies, it's called copycat violence. And I hope the psychologists jump in here and tell us this, because when there's a movie out there, I remember long ago there was a movie that showed a scene where young people were daring each other to lay in the middle of a highway at night and, of course, play chicken with cars coming. And you know what happened? Young people went out there and said, I'm going to try to do that. This is why they tell you in those thrill things, you know, do not try this at home when they're showing you some of this stuff. Because what happens is when we witness these kind of violence, people will try it. And you see these mass shootings now, that the Aurora Theater and the Newtown and the Navy Yard shooters. When you grow up being exposed to the violent video games, which by the way are used as a recruiting tool for becoming more militaristic and joining the armed services, when you see this, when you see it in our movies, you know, almost every movie now has a plot of horrific violence. On top of the fact that our government, our leaders, are extolling people like American Sniper heroes for shooting the most people as possible. So young people grow up thinking that's how I can become a hero. So ISIS, for example, when they show their videos of terrible beheadings and burnings of people alive, etc., they actually realize that what they're doing is they're encouraging more brutality and more people to say, well, I can do that too. And maybe I'll be famous, and maybe I'll be a hero, and maybe I'll be achieving some noble, heroic cause. So ISIS actually gets it better than the United States does. The United States is not understanding that the blowback from these wars is now the war come home. And again, I think it's something that's really missing. One of the things that we talk about all the time is the suicidal problem. You know, we don't have any casualties in our American troops other than suicides. And I actually have to pause here for a second because I'm on Facebook all the time, and people will say, "Oh, Colleen, you're you know, you're overreacting, etc. Well, I've personally now known, sometimes indirectly, not personally, but I've actually known people. Some of them are friends of my kids, etc. Like a dozen people that have either been killed in Afghanistan or Iraq, or have committed suicide. And just in my hometown here, 2 miles from my house, an Iraq veteran killed his wife and five-year-old last year. So it's not just suicidal violence that is a blowback of the wars. It's also homicidal. And I think this is important to understand. If people, traumatized vets and vets who have become, you know, been given this bloodlust and whatever, don't only kill themselves. They also go out in public places. The shooters that killed the police in Louisiana, he was a veteran. And actually many, we hardly ever hear it. The news always covers this up, or they bury it in the very last line of these terrible stories now about mass shootings. But the Navy Yard shooter was a vet. The D.C. sniper was a veteran. Even Timothy McVeigh, who was the top domestic terrorist in the United States, was a veteran. And we had a defense intelligence analyst who wrote this a long time ago and got pilloried for mentioning that some of our domestic terrorists would be veterans. So this kind of thing is blowing back on the United States, and until we can, and people realize that the cost to themselves, if they just think we're bombing foreigners and we're, you know, it's helping our freedom. Even Colin Kaepernick said, you know, the military veterans who went to his side and said, you know, we fought for your right to have freedom of speech. If people believe that the war is serving this good purpose of giving us our freedoms and our liberty, you know, many Americans will fall for that propaganda. But if they understand that there are direct costs to themselves, and that their own insecurity of going into a theater or a church or a school or having their kids go to school and now be scared out of their wits that somebody's going to bring a gun, and be inspired by this war violence that is all around them. And I think that's a real point that people are missing right now, because this is a cost that we're paying.
It is indeed. I think we also have to get people to care about slaughtering millions of people abroad, because people imagine that the veterans and the military families in the United States are the extent of the suffering in these wars, when 99% of the suffering is left out in that story. But that was absolutely perfect for A Day with My Sore Throat. Colleen Rowley, former 9/11 whistleblower, retired FBI agent, and leading peace activist. And I look forward to seeing you, Colleen, at No War 2016 in Washington, D.C.
Yes, I am looking forward to it, too. I just saw Jill Stein on Fox News, and she said we need more debate about these issues. And that's precisely what I hope the No War 2016 conference will do.
It will. And we need more candidates in those debates for elections for president. Thanks, Colleen.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson.
This week on Counterspin, after more than a half century of bloody conflict that saw more than 200,000, mostly poor civilians, killed, Colombia has a chance at a peace accord between the government and the FARC, the region's oldest insurgent movement. We aren't hearing too much about it in the press, and what we are might need a little interpretation. We'll get that from Mario Murillo, author of Colombia and the United States, War, Unrest, and Destabilization. Also on the show, media aim a lot of individualized advice at working women. Speak up, demand a raise, lean in, and all of that. It's important to see that there are barriers beyond a woman's level of gumption. The release of data on wage discrimination is a good time to talk about that. We'll hear from Kevin Miller of the American Association of University Women, author of their brand new report, The Simple Truth About the Gender Pay Gap. That's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a quick look back at recent press. Corporate media continue to undercover the huge mobilization of Native American nations protesting the Dakota Access Pipeline. Protesters being arrested at gunpoint, a reporter being targeted for arrest, insufficient so far to draw a single story from ABC or NBC News, for example. That kind of silence means the industry has little need to make their case there. Online is a little different, though. More people can be heard who are not in anyone's pay. Enter the bots. An investigation by DSmog blog revealed the distinct possibility that the Midwest Alliance for Infrastructure Now, or MAIN, a front group for folks like the North Dakota Petroleum Council, created fake Twitter profiles to push a pro-pipeline message on social media. At least 16 accounts using protesters' No DAPL hashtag offered thoughts like, "No DAPL people are literally protesting construction on someone else's private property. How about yes, DAPL?" And, "Taking kids to a violent protest the No DAPL people hosted is negligence. Someone call Child Protective Services." Tip-offs to shenanigans? Some of the users had identical photos. Some of those photos also appeared on a dermatologist's website and one for mail-order brides. All of them were linked to Hootsuite, a tool that lets someone toggle quickly between multiple social media accounts, and when other folks on Twitter smelled a rat, most of them disappeared overnight. Environmentalist Bill McKibben summed it up, telling DSmog's Steve Horn, quote, "The invention of fake people to make fake arguments perfectly exemplifies the tactics big oil has been reduced to. They can't win an argument on the merits, so they've given up trying. Instead, they literally make things up." Close quote. "Who has the upper hand on terrorism, Clinton or Trump?" asked Politico, September 20th. Previous day's Fox News headline was "Terror Threat Clash. Trump-Clinton Accuse Each Other of Boosting Enemy," while USA Today had "Clinton-Trump Spar Over Terrorism in Wake of Latest Attacks." Missing from these reports, notes Adam Johnson on FAIR.org, is any discussion at all of the relative danger of terrorism, which remains, objectively, a very minor threat. One is 82 times more likely to be killed falling out of bed, for example, than by a terrorist. Media inflate its role by framing the issue as an urgent danger, with two candidates dueling over opposing ways of addressing the menace. Worse, they engage in a kind of meta-terrorism, with excessive coverage of stories that don't report actual terrorist acts, but rather potential or staged terrorism, or ISIS propaganda repackaged as news. Stories like, "Online posts show ISIS eyeing Mexican border," says Law Enforcement Bulletin. Or, "A freeway terror attack is the nightmare we worry about," law enforcers say. They don't pan out, but they don't have to in order to spur panic. A panic with a not incidental, racist and xenophobic character, given media's corollary tendency to conflate terrorism with Islamic fundamentalism, or some variant thereof. Notes Johnson, it's hard to imagine Trump and Clinton jockeying for position on climate change, or violence against women and LGBT communities, or lowering heart disease. all of which statistically are far, far more dangerous than terrorism. It's also hard to imagine elite media encouraging them to. Finally, one note among many on corporate media reaction to the killing by police of, this week, Terrence Crutcher and Keith Scott. And that's just to say that when media report protests as African Americans angry about the police killing of this unarmed black man, they're getting it wrong. It's not the killing of Terrence Crutcher or of Keith Scott alone that sends people into the street. It's the existence of ongoing, everyday, state-sanctioned, unpunished lethal violence against black men, women, and children in a country with an unbroken history of it, of which whatever latest example is just that. Coverage that doesn't acknowledge that key fact is unlikely to advance the conversation. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. The peace deal signed between the government of Colombian President Juan Manuel Santos and the FARC, the largest and oldest insurgency in Latin America, is historic. More than 50 years of fighting have killed more than 220,000 Colombians, overwhelmingly poor civilians. These years have seen executions, disappearances, detentions, torture. The violence has forced some 7 million people from their homes, the largest number of internally displaced people in the world. But government negotiator Humberto de la Calle was careful in speaking to the Associated Press to say that the accord, to be approved by referendum on October 2nd, does not promise peace, but simply an end to hostilities with the FARC. True reconciliation will take much longer. Joining us now to talk about why that is Mario Murillo. He's a professor of radio, television, and film at Hofstra University and author of Colombia and the United States, War, Unrest, and Destabilization. Welcome to Counterspin, Mario Murillo.
It's great to be back with you.
Well, I think this CNN piece captures the emphasis of much U.S. coverage. It says, quote, "The outcome is not certain. The call for amnesty for the guerrillas involved in the war that killed up to 220,000 people and forced millions more from their homes is particularly controversial. Former President Álvaro Uribe Vélez opposes the peace deal, saying it gives impunity to murderers and kidnappers. Current President Juan Manuel Santos has promised that justice will be served, but details are not clear." Close quote. What that tells me is the FARC were a source of violence, and if they lay down their arms, there will be peace. The main problem is they want to escape punishment for horrors they committed, and people resent that. How do you respond to that as a sum up of history and of public opinion?
Well, this is the narrative that has been shaped for decades, really, in Colombia, that the atrocities that have been carried out in Colombia, which you outlined pretty clearly in terms of displacements, in terms of massacres, in terms of deaths, in terms of civilian casualties, was the work of the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, FARC, that they have the blood on their hands and there's hell to pay for it. And this is the way it's been pretty much for the last 20 years in terms of media coverage and in terms of U.S. foreign policy public pronunciations, in terms of the political debate in Colombia, that the FARC are the primary culprits. What this overlooks conveniently is the fact that the Colombian armed forces and their allies in the paramilitary groups that have emerged in many different manifestations over the last 20 to 25 years have just as much, if not more, blood on their hands. And that when we talk about an amnesty right now in this particular peace accord between the government of Santos and the FARC, it's not only talking about FARC responsibilities, but also military responsibilities for the atrocities they carried out during this war. And unfortunately, that's not emphasized at all in most of the coverage. It's almost like a footnote in the coverage, and it's as if there's outrage because the FARC are going to get amnestied for all these atrocities. It also overlooks that in 2006, 2007, when the former president that you referred to, Álvaro Uribe, who's kind of the poster child of the anti-FARC, anti-peace agreement movement in Colombia, he negotiated a peace deal with paramilitary groups that carried out what most human rights groups, both domestic in Colombia and international human rights group, pointed out as being up to 75% of those atrocities. He carried out a peace deal in which the majority of those paramilitaries have gone away scot-free without any punishment. So it's an unbelievable contradiction, and it's kind of glossed over, unfortunately, in most of the media coverage here in the United States.
But I wanted to draw you out on one thing, which is the record of Uribe and the pardons given to the paramilitaries, because the New York Times has just had a very big, long, compelling investigation by Deborah Sontag. You know, Sontag lays out how they were rewarded for pleading guilty. They were treated as first-time offenders and sentenced only for drug crimes when, in fact, they were guilty of human rights abuses. I wonder what you made of that kind of, you know, big, long, thoughtful piece from the New York Times just recently.
Well, first of all, that was a very good and very important piece. It came out on September 10th. It had a major spread. In fact, it was kind of ironic because on the website, the title of the article was The Secret History of Colombia's Paramilitaries and the U.S. War on Drugs. In the print edition, I believe it was a much more kind of tame title that didn't present so much the U.S. complicity in this secret history. So it's a great article, and it does detail the major role the United States played in many ways, severing the investigations and the truth commissions that were being established to really get to the bottom of the roots of the paramilitary enterprise in Colombia, which was not simply a kind of a counterinsurgency war that was being waged by a bunch of drug traffickers, as it was often presented in the news, drug traffickers that had these illegal armies. It wasn't just kind of this random violence that was being carried out in the countryside against FARC sympathizers, etc., but that it was a systematic process in which high levels of the Colombian economic and political establishment were directly involved in, including Álvaro Uribe and people close to Álvaro Uribe. And when that investigation, when that process was unfolding and it was getting closer and closer to the circles of Uribe, that's when the United States extradition request of some of the top leadership was implemented and pushed out. So the New York Times article by Sontag is very good in outlining that and describing that. But we were talking about this so many years ago, and the Colombian human rights community was outraged by it, and the New York Times was pretty silent on it. Yes, there was a couple of editorials at the time criticizing the U.S. role in doing that, but there was no intense coverage that it certainly warranted, considering the role that the United States Plan Colombia, military assistance, training, all the efforts that the U.S. was involved in Colombia, the role it played directly and indirectly in this paramilitary war that was being carried out. So the Times was, at best, very late in this story.
Yeah, it has a kind of now it can be told feel to it. Well, but over at the Washington Post, they're not denying or undermining the U.S. role. They have a piece with a headline, U.S. Intervention Helped Turn the Tide in Colombia. And it's kind of a victory lap. Nick Miroff says after 16 years and $10 billion, the once controversial security aid package is celebrated today by many Republicans and Democrats in Congress as one of the top U.S. foreign policy achievements of the 21st century. He's talking about Plan Colombia. So what do we need to know about that?
I think it's the utmost in cynicism. And when we hear Hillary Clinton point to Plan Colombia as a success in U.S. foreign policy in Latin America, it disturbs us who've been watching this for so long unfold. Because if you look at the history, if you understood the history, Plan Colombia was initially a plan being proposed by the former president, Andrés Pastrana, to deal with the rural lack of development, lack of infrastructure, lack of support for poor peasant farmers in the countryside that essentially gave the foundations of the FARC to begin with. So Plan Colombia initially was an idea that Pastrana pushed forward sort of as a Marshall Plan to develop the countryside and to address this poverty, this displacement, et cetera, as a way to address the drug problem in Colombia. But Clinton at that time, and I write about it in my book in 2004, Clinton basically edited it. The State Department with the Pentagon, they basically said, no, the plan has to be we have to carry out an offensive against the guerrillas. They're the main problem. And so that's how the military package, aid package, the several billion dollars in aid started getting implemented. It was completely reversed, and it became a complete security, strategic military package first and foremost. And so, yes, there's no question about it. The war changed after that. The FARC was devastated as a result of it, losing from 20,000 to about 10,000 to 7,000 members that it has today. There was no question that it was a military success. But that also comes at a cost of 15 years of displacement, 15 years of violence, 15 years of false positives in which the Colombian military themselves, the supposedly professionalized Colombian military, under Plan Colombia, carried out massive sweeps of poor communities in the urban centers of Colombia, kidnapping 17, 18, 20-year-olds, killing them on the spot, dressing them up as FARC and presenting those as war trophies, saying how successful their war against the guerrillas was. And all of this is completely ignored by this victory lap of Plan Colombia and its success in bringing the FARC to the negotiating table and bringing us to this point of peace. We have to celebrate the fact that this negotiation has happened, that we're that much closer to ending the conflict between the FARC and the government, but it should not be celebrated as a victory, considering the thousands of people who were killed as a result during this process, millions displaced, and the devastation it has caused to Colombia.
Well, the October 2nd referendum required to approve the accord will ask simply, do you support the final accord to end the conflict and build a stable and lasting peace? In your recent article for The Independent, you explain that while the answer to do you support peace can be an unreserved yes, it doesn't mean that there aren't real concerns about the how, because the accord doesn't only talk about demobilizing the FARC. What are the concerns that you're talking about there?
Ignoring the backlash and opposition from the right wing in Colombia, as personified most visibly by Álvaro Uribe, the former president and current senator, which just puts out nothing but misinformation about the peace deal in an attempt to derail it. But there is considerable concern from the social movements, from the indigenous, the Afro-Colombian, the peasant movement, the rural farmers, who see that notwithstanding the fact that they applaud the fact that they're closing this chapter in the long history of violence in Colombia, the FARC surrendering their weapons and demobilizing is a positive advance, there is not necessarily a clear picture as to how the interests and the concerns of these communities are going to be addressed in this. Because on the one hand, the section on the accords that talks about rural development and kind of looking at the agrarian reform and all the things that need to be addressed in the countryside, while those are positive steps, at the same time, Santos and his government are very clear that they're going to continue with the neoliberal model of granting mining concessions in the countryside, opening up even more investment in terms of single crop agriculture from both domestic and international agribusiness, and privatizing collective territories, including in indigenous lands that were guaranteed in the 1991 constitution. Gains that were had decades, 25 years ago are now being reversed at the same time that we're celebrating a peace process. So again, I say this with caution because we celebrate. I personally, covering this for so many years and this, being close to this for so many years, I celebrate the fact that this peace accord is moving forward, and I hope it wins in terms of the referendum. But at the same time, we can't be blind to the fact that the social justice component of peace with justice is still a long way away given the trajectory of the current Colombian government.
We've been speaking with Mario Murillo. His article, After 50 Years of War, A Chance at Peace, appears in the September 19th issue of The Independent, online at independent.org. Thank you so much, Mario Murillo, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for looking at Colombia in this way.
Every now and again, media will release a list of best places to work if you're a woman, citing companies that treat women, well, fairly. Surely meant to be a spotlight on good guys, these features give the dispiriting impression that fair treatment for women at work is a matter of noblesse oblige, and the onus is on women to shop around till they find a job where they won't be discriminated against. A fundamental reflection of that discrimination is, of course, the gender pay gap. The census data used to figure out the pay gap was released recently, and the American Association of University Women has put together their report analyzing it. Here to talk about where we're at is Kevin Miller, senior researcher at AAUW and author of the new report, The Simple Truth About the Gender Pay Gap. He joins us now by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Counterspin, Kevin Miller.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I can't resist asking it this way. What is the simple truth about the gender pay gap?
Well, the simple truth about the gender pay gap is that it's real, it's substantial, and it's not going away on its own.
I think some people think it's a straight-up comparison of men and women in identical jobs. It's not really that. How do you sort out the pay gap?
The big number, the overall number that people talk the most about is a comparison of women who work full-time year-round and men who work full-time year-round. And that number this year is 80%. Women make 80% what men make in that category. So there's a 20% gap.
We can talk more about how it plays out along various vectors, but I did just want to ask you, the fact that you titled the report The Simple Truth suggests that there are some ideas that call for dispelling with regard to the gender pay gap, and one of them you seem to be saying is simply that it exists.
Yes, I think there are a lot of people who dislike the idea that there is a gender pay gap for whatever reason. One source of confusion is that people think that this 80-20 number is a comparison of not just apples to apples, but, you know, gala apples to gala apples. And they assume it's meant to represent a man and a woman working side by side in the same company in the same job. And that's just not the case. A lot of people criticize the number by saying accurately that men and women are working in different jobs. Mm-hmm. And so the number includes doctors and nurses, it includes secretaries and their bosses, it includes parking lot attendants and childcare workers. That is a big part of the gap, is that men and women end up in different jobs. But men and women end up in different jobs for a lot of reasons, including gender norms and gender roles, including gender bias. And so what we do in the report is talk about all these different factors. The fact is that the gap is substantial, and even if you account for things like occupation, that the gap is still there. And so some of the gap is, we're pretty sure, statistically, due to actual bias and actual discrimination.
That's what they call the unexplained gap, isn't it? After you account for these other factors, it's what's left over, that it's hard to know what else to attribute it to besides...
Exactly. So if you look at things like work hours, college major, occupation, industry, all these things that do explain part of the gap, if you look at all those things and statistically control for them, multiple studies by AAUW, by economists, and by other researchers show that there is a remaining unexplained gap. And that gap, we're pretty sure, is due to various forms of bias or discrimination.
Well, there's a great piece by John Miller in Dollars and Cents where he talks about folks like the Independent Women's Forum who tend to make the claim that, well, women just choose jobs that have less risk and women choose jobs that have more flexibility. And it's not only what we've just saying that the methodology accounts for that, but it's also just not true empirically.
Yeah, and I mean, at this point, there's a lot of what we call gender occupational segregation in the workforce. And so men and women are in different jobs, and there's a lot of reasons for that. But even when they are in the same job, even when you compare doctors to doctors and lawyers to lawyers and parking lot attendants to parking lot attendants, there's still a gap. In almost every occupation, men make more.
Well, we know that it's very hard to focus on problems that don't get measured. Your research is breaking out some new categories with the data this time around that maybe shed light on some intersections. What's new this time around? What was revealed?
This time we wanted to really cast the widest net possible to catch the statistics and the information that affect the most groups. And so we looked for the first time this year at issues of disability, so workers with disabilities, and also sexual orientation and gender identity. And what we find, unsurprisingly to me anyway, is that the gender pay gap follows women into all areas, regardless of exactly how you cut the data. So workers with disabilities, unsurprisingly, make less on average than workers without disabilities. But whether you're looking at workers without disabilities or workers with disabilities, men make more than women in those categories. And likewise, if you consider the effect of sexual orientation and gender identity, women still, again, overall tend to make less regardless of their sexual orientation. There are some interesting effects if you look at, for instance, comparing gay or bisexual men to heterosexual men, mm-hmm. where gay and bisexual men on average make less money than heterosexual men. So there are some interesting other factors to consider, but the gender pay gap is pretty universal.
Well, and I don't want folks to think we skipped over race, because I know that we've seen work indicating, I believe, that although the gender wage gap has narrowed between white women's wages and those of white men's over a longer period of time, black women have split off in a different direction, that wage gap seems to be going the wrong way as well.
Yes, and that's something that a lot of people have a lot of critiques about how this issue is discussed. And one critique that you hear from the left that I think is valid is that if you look at this 80-20 number, that it really doesn't talk about race or these other factors. And we do see that if you look at Latino women and Black women, that their wages are much lower, especially than white men, but also lower than white women. And so I think it's important to talk about the sorts of discrimination and also life experiences and opportunities that are resulting in these much larger gaps for some women.
Yes, and, you know, the data is there to be used in that way. You know, it's just data. We can put it together to show lots of things. And one of the things that it would also be connected to, of course, is we're hearing at the same time a kind of qualified celebration about the new poverty numbers. But we can't consider that in isolation from this either, can we?
I think that's right. The new numbers that came out this past week were really positive in terms of income and poverty. We saw that incomes were up and poverty was down. And I think that's great news. But again, it's important to talk about for whom the gains were largest and who didn't see gains. And I think, again, if you look at the gender pay gaps by race, if you consider income and poverty and unemployment numbers by race and ethnicity, you see that, you know, there are very different patterns for some populations in the United States. So I do think it's very much critical to bring up those topics and talk about them constructively.
Well, let me just ask you, finally, it all suggests a multi-front fight. You know, it can't just be the Paycheck Fairness Act. You'd have to also talk about raising the minimum wage, family-friendly policies. A lot of the report has to do with recommendations, doesn't it?
Yes, absolutely. And I think that we want to see sort of a multi-front fight for fairness for women and what they earn. As you said, the Paycheck Fairness Act and other laws are critical. AAUW fights for fair enforcement and strong enforcement of existing laws and regulations as well. But I think a lot of this also goes back to gender norms, social roles. We're very much interested in making sure that women are supported and free from discrimination and harassment in all workplaces, whether those are traditionally female jobs or more traditionally male jobs, like especially, for instance, the tech sector. And I think the more that can be done across the board, the better off women will be in the long run.
We've been speaking with Kevin Miller of the American Association of University Women. Find the new report, The Simple Truth About the Gender Pay Gap, online at aauw.org. Kevin Miller, thanks for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks so much.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
From Antarctica to Europe, it's hot, hot, hot. According to NASA, this past July and August are tied for the hottest months since humans could keep such records on planet Earth. The Arctic sea ice is the second lowest ever recorded. Russian fires are intense. And Northern Europeans just enjoyed a second summer in the middle of September. They hit the beaches. What will humans do in a climate-damaged future? In this program, we look at the most awful with science fiction writer Anthony J. Gerst, with the dash of hope after that by carbon herder Ariel Greenwood. In between, you'll hear two new climate rap songs from master entertainer Baba Brinkman. I'm Alex, on with the show. We all want to peer into the future, predicting or guessing what life will be like. When it comes to climate change, science offers some convincing predictions. But we don't know how that climate shift will play out really, and what about in the complex world of debt and financing and invention and war the way we humans are? Our next guest, Anthony J. Gerst, has been following current affairs for decades, Since the 1980s, he's been writing op-eds and letters to editors on many continents. Now Gerst has assembled what he knows into a vision of the new world after a climate catastrophe. The book is The Harp Letters, A Climate-Changing Reality from Crimson Cloak Publishing. Anthony lives where the Iowa River flows into the mighty Mississippi. Anthony Gerst, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex.
Well, just to clear the air right off, I assume your book is not part of the HAARP conspiracy, the folks who believe that the secret American military facility in Alaska is controlling our weather and maybe our minds. Why did you use this name in your title?
Part of the reason was marketing. I was helping to reach out to that audience as well in selling the book and getting them this information. I had written about climate change for over a decade, and I have decided that I wanted to get the science fiction audience, environmental audience, and if possible, why not reach out to the more conspiracy-minded among us with a little bit of fact.
On this show, we've talked about the new genre of climate-based science fiction. It's called cli-fi. A Taiwan-based journalist named Dan Bloom coined that term, and it was partly an email between us. Is your new book cli-fi, do you think?
It would definitely qualify under cli-fi. It is true science fiction, as well as I have extrapolated upon nanotechnology as an example to create what I called crib sheets. These are a futuristic computer that would be like a small piece of plastic that could actually be rolled up and just stuck in your pocket. They have a 10,000-year life with the battery. They can project multiple three-dimensional hollow screens. Plus, they are AI. They can learn and store all the information from each user during this time frame. And that's one example of the science fiction aspect of my writing as well.
I think it would be hard to write a book about climate always sliding a bit hotter every year and more violent over several human lifetimes. That may be the way it plays out. We don't really know. Instead, you presume a major event to kick things off that ends one civilization and starts another. What is the event that you use?
I use an event that I have called Big Thunder. This is a plausible event, the probability of which is above my mathematical pay grade to compute. What happens, you're well aware of, and I'm sure you even know Jason Box and his scientific information that's coming out of Greenland, that there are large amounts of increased melt on the surface of the ice sheet that are drawing what I call molens, open air tubes down to the bottom of the ice sheet. This is lubricating it, increasing the speed at which it's moving, and the increased calving. The important part of this that I want to focus on is at some point in the future, there will be enough air pockets in the ice sheet that a sonic vibrational wave will cause major calving to hit. The Mid-Atlantic Ridge in this northern periphery is overdue for an earthquake of over 4.0 and has been overdue for over 100 years. So this is the trigger mechanism that I use that sends out sonic vibration hitting the Greenland ice cap, if you want to call it, you know, an ice cap, and knocks half of it into the ocean to start off with. That, of course, shuts down the Atlantic conveyor belt. The tsunamis sweep out, taking out large sections of the population around the globe. 2 weeks later, due to the reduction of the weight on the island juts upwards, knocking off the rest of the ice. And once again, I'm sure your well-informed audience is well aware of the amount of gigatons of methane and carbohydrates that are in the floor of the ocean around Greenland. This would release into the atmosphere, triggering, you know, instantaneous change.
Well, getting back, say, to your area in America, you talk as though that would develop into badlands. What do you actually picture happening where the majority of people live if we had a mega event?
Well, civilization, global JIT, just-in-time delivery system, would crash rapidly. There would be major pandemics because of the amount of death that was caused along the coastal regions, putting bodies onto the land. They could not be interned properly. The pandemics would sweep the globe for at least 7 years at a minimum, I would say. With the breakdown of the global JIT, I would see the interior cities around the globe basically turn into complete chaos, fighting for the remaining resources that they have available to them, at which point they would start to branch out and go into the countryside. going after people that have stocked up supplies, say, from, like gardening. I've gardened, and I have a lot of produce stocked up. People would come out and want to target those type of areas to get their food for survival. It would be, in my opinion, chaos.
Well, actually, that did happen in the 30s in the Ukraine, where people were starving in Moscow, and they just sent big trucks out with soldiers and took every last bit of grain, including the seed grain, from the people in Ukraine who starved to death in the millions. But that's another story. Well, now, some catastrophe books stop at the last survivors living in some cave by themselves. You've gone a lot further. You envision a new economy that could come after this civilization falls. Do you want to talk to us about that, Anthony Gerst?
Well, the new economy, I have it based on Earth-first sustainability practices, using industrial hemp and actually growing marijuana as medicine uses. It uses bamboo, it uses flax, and the entire new civilization. Bear in mind there are five doomsday shelters. I only deal with the Hearth compound in the first book, but there, the new civilization is based on a merit-based educational system where people do ongoing education and can change their professions and get into different roles. The key stressor is limiting the size of cities so they're manageable and maintaining a sustainability factor with Mother Earth or being able to fit into the web of life.
All right. Now, you mentioned marijuana. The Canadian federal government, I live in Canada, has promised to legalize marijuana in 2017. That's going to be a major event. I gather you're interested in the role of hemp, but really in the role it can play in the future economy. What can hemp do for us?
Oh, hemp's actually quite a miraculous little plant. If you go into extreme research into it, you can find things from back in the 1930s from the United States government. They're hard to come by, let me tell you. But first of all, hemp makes excellent paper. It uses far less trees. It's a renewable crop. Hemp can take marginal soil, if properly employed, and rejuvenate it quite rapidly, actually. You can make building materials. You can make hempcrete. You can use hemp resin for various compounds. The cellulosic materials found in hemp curds can basically, if you can make it with oil-based cellulosic material, you can make it with hemp. So plastics, etc. Plus, roll like hempcrete, once it hardens, continues to draw carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere for its entire life, which is an obvious benefit at our time. In the soil itself being rejuvenated, the crop brings out carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, releases oxygen, another good benefit. I have written papers in the past on just the scientific aspect of this and how it could be used to promote our current economy for at least, I speculate there, 100 years by using this in third world countries where they could actually rotate the crops three times during the year and simply using it there to make paper products, manufacturing building products, and exporting the raw material of the herds to secondary and primary, you know, first world nations for more technological uses.
Yeah, I think the replacement of cement for concrete is very important because it's a huge source of global warming gases right now. I don't exactly understand how hempcrete works. Do you still have to burn a bunch of natural gas to make it?
I do not believe so. Unfortunately, this has been several years now that I wrote the first section of the book, and I did not have the opportunity to go in and completely review all my hemp information because it's like 2 feet of papers. But no, I don't know about the manufacturing of it. I do know afterwards, though, that it is definitely a plus. And I highly doubt that it would produce the same amount of methane. Is it not methane that comes out of creating concrete?
I'm not sure. I think it's more just the CO2 from the firing up of the furnaces that you need in order to create cement.
Okay.
I think that's where most of the climate change gases come from. And it's like 5% of human emissions or something. It's huge because we use cement all over the place. Well, this is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Anthony J. Gerst, author of The Harp Letters, A Climate-Changing Reality. Getting back to your book, Anthony, can you tell us, it takes like the form of letters from the future, is that right?
That is correct, yes.
And so one of the earlier letters from the future, just talk to us about what we might expect in one of those letters.
The earlier letters in the book actually setting up the new world and giving some reflection into what brought them to this state. It is sets up the entire series, actually. One of them that I'm particularly fond of is Seasons of Remembrance. For me, it was good to write because I could reflect back to the 1970s growing up, when there were definitely marked changes between spring, summer, fall, and winter, and things seemed to blend together so much more than now. And there's the mixture of when the trees will bloom and everything's getting mixed up as everything changes and the earth continues to rise in temperature.
For sure. All the fruit near us came in 3 weeks earlier this year. We don't know really when winter starts or whether we'll get much of a winter, so it's hard to imagine that those great big cycles that we grew up with and all the animals and plants depend upon are blurring.
Exactly.
Already. And if we had a major event like you're talking about, they'll just shift so far, I don't know what plants and animals would even survive.
Yeah, I would like to point out as well that if a shift like I'm explaining or any abrupt climate-changing event would occur, the scenario that I set up where I install ancient Paleolithic climate that they believe existed, where the Antarctic had their own ocean conveyor belts, and then the Badlands, what I call them, the mid-latitudes, would be poisoned, probably would never come to pass because of the methane emissions from the Arctic. It would actually act as the fire under a Bunsen burner in heating our planet.
Well, talk to us about some of the major social changes that you envision might follow a catastrophic collapse of this civilization we live in now.
Okay, I have five doomsday shelters. They will each represent a different aspect of humanity's current cultural paradigm. In the Harp letters, though, what I am striving for is a change in a theological aspect, our educational aspect, and the economy. As I say, it'll be based more on a combination of, well, dare I say, socialism and private barter and trade.
Is the gift economy going to be part of that?
Oh, definitely the gift economy is part of that.
A lot of people don't understand what that is. How do you envision a gift economy working?
A gift economy is where an individual would take their own particular assets to create something, and it would be exchanged to other individuals for their specific talents. A mutual bartering system to help out more or less a, if you want to say, tribal aspect of a community. Do not think of tribal as extremely small or primitive. The city-states would be roughly at maximum 5,000 people, and I've used that off of, I believe it was Socrates who said that was the ideal size for a democratic participation, because this is still a society where everybody's allowed to chip in their opinions on major decisions. Yes, I see a gift economy and a mutual rotation that is done by the educational society of everyone having to spend so many hours a week working in different aspects. These individuals within a city all have an individual plot where they can grow stuff for themselves, and they all have a 10-by-10 plot that they maintain for production of industrial hemp, which would go to the hemp processing center to make all the products for the community.
I love it. The great leap forward, but with hemp. You know, actually, Anthony, on the west coast of Canada, the First Nations people had a system of a gift economy in the sense that they would get together in great gatherings and then give away what they had. There was really no process. You could trade, but there was no process to buy something that came down a long chain of people you don't know, and then it's yours and it's nobody else's. So certainly we have lived other ways in the past, and under a huge climate stress, these things could come back.
Well, that would be ideal. I would like to see something like this happen before one of these events actually transpire. My problem with that, and I'm sure yours as well, is we can look at humanity and see the tribal us versus them concept, or paleo us versus them concept, if you want, in regards to so many aspects of our current paradigm, be it nation states, ideologies, theologies. Unless we learn to come together as a people, we have no hope, in my opinion, of mitigating the circumstances that are in the pipeline and heading towards us at this time.
Well, given where we are, do you think we have to break the system to make a new one?
I think the system has to collapse in order to make a new one, yes, simply because I do not see the willpower, well, one, in the people to unite as one, but that would happen long before the status quo that controls the fiscal and governmental aspects of the globe would surrender their power. I stress a lot in here, and especially in the series, that the greatest danger to mankind is our greed and our power lust. And will we be able to overcome these? Two of the doomsday shelters, the heart compound being one, works towards integrating within the web of life. The other two will represent more materialistic and current consumeristic exploitation of the natural world around them, while the fifth, which is deep underground at the CERN Collider, takes on another sci-fi aspect in that living that deep down, they live in dark conditions because they're devoting all the energy towards their high-tech projects. These were the smartest people on the planet when everything went to crap. And by the time the 10,000-year series is done, 10 books jumping ahead every 1,000 years, these people become what we think of now as grays.
As what?
The gray aliens.
Oh, okay, because a lot of people are not familiar with gray aliens.
Yeah, this throws in the science fiction aspect to the book as well. I think it's important. It's important for me anyway as a writer to have a science fiction aspect in this work because it extrapolates from current knowledge and projects what could happen. Their eyes grow bigger over generations because of deep underground living in a darkened environment, so it grows bigger to allow more light in. Their skin becomes more translucent and eventually turns more of a gray because they're not exposed to direct sunlight. So this gives off then the appearance. They're not going to have the extremely bulbous heads of what a gray alien would or three fingers, but they would take on some attributes to where they would look alien to the people on the surface.
Well, you know, it's strange because I know that the first mammals had to go underground. They were very small. They were like mice. They were our ancestors. During a previous climate disaster that happened about 55 million years ago, it was just too hot to live above the surface. So all of that's still possible, and there are great caves. Even in the United States, there's some huge thing, I don't know if it's in Missouri, but it's in the central United States, where the American government built a giant city underground. It's got a post office and a police station and warehouses for companies to drive trucks around under there in these great caverns. So all of that, you know, it's ticking away as a possibility.
Plausibility is how I look at them because, once again, the probability of survival there in a climate-changing situation would have to do with the atmospheric change. One of the doomsday shelters I have in the, I believe it's pronounced Vihenek Range in Russia, but it's right on the border of where the Badlands and the Arctic would be.
Mm-hmm.
So what I do here is take the poisoned atmosphere over generations that they are at times breathing as it shifts northward in the atmospheric circulation pattern, and it basically not retards but regresses their human development. I've seen reports that autism can be caused from environmental factors, one of which is mercury coming from foods and stuff, compiled with several other environmental factors. So this is how I'm extrapolating doing that and projecting that into the future as well.
Well, again, that might sound outlandish, but we've had a very important scientist, Peter Ward, on this show saying that in a previous climate mass extinction, that he thinks that what happened was that the atmosphere did become poisoned because of a change of creatures in the sea that were emitting sulfur dioxide, which is poisonous to us, and that would have washed over the mainland and killed off the creatures that breathed it, except for, he thinks, the dinosaurs developed some ability to survive it because of differences in their lungs. So what you're talking about sounds outrageous for the future, and certainly it's not going to happen in the near future, but it has happened in the past, so maybe.
Yeah. I found that interesting. I was unaware of that aspect of it. I use algae blooms, cyanobacteria blooms,
mm-hmm.
as the transmission device that carries the atmosphere over and across near the shorelines. And now the other ones are just the standard atmospheric transmissions. But, yeah, that's intriguing information. Thank you.
So how can people get a taste of your writing, Anthony?
You throw in Anthony J. Perry Gerst in a search engine with quote marks. You ought to be able to get a little bit of everything from, my letters to the editor. Boomer Warrior is based in Canada. That's an environmental site. I wrote for them in the very beginning before my book was accepted by Crimson Cloak Publishing and I took directions. But I have like 5 articles of Boomer Warrior. Op-Ed News is another source. It was an online featured blogger for Planet Save before they changed. I'm sure they were sold out to a major corporation that didn't quite like my controversial style of writing.
I'm just going to say, from the heartland of America, we've been talking with author and observer Anthony J. Gerst, and you can find his vision of a possible future after climate disruption in the book, The Harp Letters, A Climate-Changing Reality. It's on Amazon, of course, and on Kindle, too. You can follow Anthony on Twitter with the hashtag @climatewriter. That's a pretty basic tag, and I think it shows how early Anthony got into all this. Thank you so much for talking with us, Anthony J. Gerst.
I thank you today, Alex, and thank you for the opportunity to reach your audience.
Radio EcoShock.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. In just a couple of minutes, we'll talk with a bright young voice living out one of the best hopes to avert the worst of climate change. But first, we turn to the Canadian rapper and playwright Baba Brinkman. Believe it or not, he set the ponderously named Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, into modern rap. Give it a listen.
Definition of hardcore. Check out the Intergovernmental Climate Report. It says the world is getting warmer unequivocally, and the oceans have increased 30% in acidity, and 90% of the warming trend is oceanic and concentrated in the Arctic. Nobody panic, but the level of greenhouse gases in the air is higher now than it's been in millions of years. We added more than a trillion tons of CO2 to the atmosphere. It's gonna be centuries before some of the gas is clear. I'm dropping science unvarnished, unbiased, but I don't blame you if your instinct is to deny it, cause we evolved to prioritize immediate threats. If it bleeds, it leads, that's what the media says. So let the gangster-esque rap music paint a picture, and I'll hit you with some evidence-based predictions. Get ready for wars, famines, droughts, floods, hurricanes, heat waves, murders, thugs, chaos, refugees, stress, disease, extinction, disaster, IPCC. Wars, famines, droughts, IPCC.
Hollywood summer blockbusters can't touch this. I get my thrills from the latest reports published by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, formed in 1988 to get the science straight. Now they dropped the 5th assessment and the data's up to date, so allow me to summarize. Bad things on the way, higher emissions, sea level rise, dire predictions, on target for disaster movie style predicaments. In Copenhagen we set a limit of 2 degrees, but that's still enough to disintegrate major ice sheets over the course of centuries, or maybe decades. Yeah, some of the details are still up for debate. They fluctuate between certain disaster and likely disaster. Slow and steady or higher and faster. Consensus, it's the lowest common denominator, which means it's probably gonna be way worse than the wars, famines, droughts, floods, hurricanes, heat waves, murders, thugs, chaos, refugees, stress, disease, extinction, disaster, IPCC. Wars, famines, droughts, floods, hurricanes, heat waves, murders, thugs, chaos, refugees, stress, disease, extinction, disaster, IPCC. So be afraid, be
very afraid, but we're not, despite what the scenarios say. And the effect of talking about it is visible yawning, and occasionally changing our behavior microscopically. And even those who get it tend to get it logically, but not viscerally. So we're navigating myopically. The threat is existential, it's not environmental, and your individual response is inconsequential. Only coordination of our whole species is gonna keep coastal cities from sinking below the deep seas. And when was the last time a solution included all of us? Geophysics is at the mercy of geopolitics. Climate change communicators, keep it positive. People need to feel like they still have options, and we do have options. Either we find a solution or we stick with the business as usual level pollution and get used to the wars, famines, droughts, floods, hurricanes, heat waves, murders, thugs, chaos, refugees, stress, disease, extinction, disaster, IPCC. Wars, famines, droughts, floods, hurricanes, heat waves, murders, thugs, chaos, refugees, stress, disease, extinction, disaster, IPCC.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. I'll put a link to my 2014 interview with Bava Brinkman in my show blog at ecoshock.info, and we'll hear one more Brinkman piece at the end of this program. But right now, let's look at how we could put massive amounts of carbon back into the soil using nature instead of abusing her. There's a lot of different job descriptions. One that often draws a blank for our next guest is herdis. Ariel Greenwood isn't just talking about holistic agriculture or putting carbon back into the soil. She's living it and right through the long-lasting California drought. From Santa Rosa, California, Ariel Greenwood, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. It's really nice to be here with you.
So, Ariel, what do you tell people you do for a living?
Oh, it depends on who I'm talking to. Generally I say that I work with animals in a restoration context. Sometimes I say I manage cattle and so on. But, you know, more so than herdis lately, I've been identifying as a grazer, which is not a common term here in the U.S. I think it's pretty ubiquitous amongst our Australian friends. But I usually choose that word instead of, you know, maybe rancher, just because I think words like rancher have all kinds of different connotations for different people, a lot of which are maybe inaccurate or unfair. And so because the work that I do is really about the process of working with animals in a restorative context, more so than any particular final product, I like to use grazer to sort of emphasize that part.
All right. Now, would you tell us a bit about Pepperwood Preserve?
Sure. So Pepperwood Preserve is a 3,200-acre private operating foundation in the Mayakama Mountains of Sonoma County, California. We're about an hour and a half north of San Francisco. So I work on site there. I'm not actually employed by Pepperwood. I'm employed by a small company called Holistic Ag. But the cool thing about Pepperwood is that while it is a, you know, conservation-focused land base, it is a preserve through and through. Everybody there is pretty progressive in their conservation ethics and fairly adventuresome. So a case in point for that is just the fact that they are working with us to use management-intensive and planning-intensive grazing to improve grassland. And, you know, it's unique in California because so much of California grassland has been highly degraded, whether through mismanagement or lack of management, overgrazing, undergrazing, et cetera, for really a couple of centuries, I think you could argue. So to use cattle, which have been a pretty destructive force in the landscape, as a restorative force, it's in some ways a novel thing out here, but our results so far are supporting our work.
How many cattle are you looking after?
Around 150. I believe 152 at my last count. And it's a growing herd. We're not yet to carrying capacity of our land base. The best way to think about that, though, is in terms of animal units, which is essentially 1,000 pounds of animals. So since we are a cow-calf through finish operation, which means we are breeding and finishing animals here in the same herd and the same land base, we have animals of varying ages. So we're at about 105 animal units, so that's 105,000 pounds of animals that I'm working with on a daily basis to move them across the landscape.
Wow. Well, you know, I did interview the producer of Cowspiracy, Kip Anderson, and that interview remains quite popular. People are downloading it. And so some of the people who care about nature think it's a crime to eat beef. And I know you run into that. What do you say?
I do. Yeah, it's a complicated conversation, but it is one that's worth having. And I should say the first thing on that note is that I really appreciate having conversations with people who are thinking and caring about that, because I think really the reason industrially raised livestock, in particular beef, has become such an egregious force on our global ecosystem is because too few people cared. Too few people were actually watching the inputs and outputs and the requisite land use that supported that system. So now that people are starting to care, we're kind of doing, you know, a 180, and the pendulum is swinging arguably too far the other way. But I'd rather kind of work with and be in conversation with people who are sensitive to the welfare of animals and operators and land. So really what I say, though, is I try to invite people into a conversation about grasslands, because I find that most people think about it purely from an agricultural perspective and often purely from an ethical perspective, in the sense of a particular ethical persuasion they have, and then they're working deductively from there. My starting point in how I interact with the landscape is I want to be a beneficial, restorative force anywhere I am. So because my context, my landscape of choice is California, native California grassland, because that landscape has been neglected for so long, it makes sense to be using domestic livestock in this context. And, you know, one of the encouraging things that I'm finding is that when you appeal to ecology, and in particular an ecology that people really resonate with, you know, most people maybe haven't had a lot of meaningful experiences with native grassland, but just the image of sort of sweeping open fields with some, you know, tree-dotted savanna, I think resonates with a very deep and old part of us. So when you can literally and figuratively ground the conversation, people let their guard down and they start to expand their thinking away from this binary view of is it right or wrong to kill animals or is it right or wrong to eat meat, into a more holistic question of what is my bioregion and then what kind of stewardship does my bioregion require? And then how do I, as an eater, who is going to have an impact on that bioregion for good or for bad, how do I make decisions that are in keeping with that understanding? So that's kind of where I'm trying to steer the conversation these days and really leave people with more questions than answers, because I think once we have questions about things, we have the sort of humble posture required to explore.
Well, now, it caught my attention. I think it was on your Facebook page, could have been on your website, where you were slated to give a talk called Regenerative Agriculture, Buzzword or Last Hope for Reversing Climate Change. What do you tell people about the role of farming in the climate fight?
Sure. Yeah, that talk was actually just yesterday in San Francisco at the Social Capital Conference. It was a panel with some other really, really great people. You know, it's a big conversation, but I would say that agriculture is really the greatest force that we have. It's the way we exert ourselves and kind of throw our anthropogenic weight around the planet, you know. And because of that, because we have an agricultural system that is extremely dependent upon fossil fuels and especially on mismanagement of soil, our climatic situation can be pretty much directly attributed to the choices we've made as agrarian humans for the past 10 or 12,000 years. But when you look at the specific components of that, especially soil management, you find that, okay, if a big part of the problem is that we've been abusing our soil, we've been destroying our soil, overgrazing our soil, undergrazing our grasslands, but especially tilling our soil to produce annual commodity crops to feed humans or livestock or produce biofuels. The obvious answer is that we just need to find a way to produce the goods that we want to consume in a way that builds rather than destroys soil, or we need to adjust the goods that we consume to something that is inherently non-destructive, such as switching our diets more towards a perennial food system. And I referred a lot of people to the book Carbon Farming by Eric Tonesmeyer. His livestock section definitely needs an update. There's been some interesting research coming out with scientific research verifying the beneficial role of plan grazing in a lot of contexts. But overall, his exploration of the role of tillage and how we can change the way we produce food and change the kinds of food that we produce, it's our biggest and best leverage point. And, you know, Gregory Landway was the host of the panel that I was on yesterday, and he's a really great mind in the regenerative agriculture scene. And some of your listeners may know him from something he produced along with Ethan Rowland called The Eight Forms of Capital. So this notion of multi-capital enterprises as opposed to strictly measuring things in terms of their, you know, monetary value. He was making the point that we actually have the single most profound tool to reverse climate change, and we've had it all along, and that's very simply photosynthesis. You know, the very act of photosynthesis takes CO2 from the atmosphere and produces biomass. And the problem now is that we're not then returning that biomass into the strata of our soil where it can be stored essentially in perpetuity, provided that soil remains intact. So it's curious when I hear, you know, friends of mine, especially in the Bay Area, who are getting excited about geoengineering or getting excited about synthesized protein and so on, spending a whole lot of money and a lot of their lives in these supposedly new technologies that we need, when in fact we have the best technology, it's photosynthesis, but the problem is just that we don't have the people systems there to wield photosynthesis in a really responsible way. We're still very extractive.
I totally agree with you there, you know, because getting carbon back into the soil, in my opinion, it really is our last best hope. That's where carbon belongs. There's way more carbon in the soil than in the atmosphere, and there used to be a lot more before we started doing the type of farming that we're doing. I guess one of the barriers is how we transmit the tech of holistic agriculture to millions of farmers speaking hundreds of languages all over the world. Can we do it? Can we do it in time? What do you think?
That's a great question. So the company I agree with, Holistic Ag, which was founded by Aaron Lucich a few years back, we found that there seems to be kind of a mycelial network of things, which is will be no surprise to you and a lot of your listeners, but there's an exponential growth in excitement over grazing, land stewardship, soil, et cetera, which, by which I mean that the work that we're doing is serving as proof of concept for this stuff. And so the amount of land that, you know, we could potentially access this year is significantly more than the year prior and the year prior and so on. So that kind of upward exponential growth and interest and opportunity is extremely exciting to me. And I think it actually can outpace the problem. You know, the group that's doing the most to spread holistic management, which is a decision-making platform, and the way that we practice that is especially in planned grazing, but holistic management lends itself to so many things. The group responsible for propagating that the most globally is the Savory Institute, which was started by Alan Savory, who is the progenitor and mastermind behind holistic management. And, you know, folks from the Savory Institute, I was just talking to Chris Kirsten, who is Alan's right-hand man, the other day. He said they were testifying before Congress, which they'd never done before. So the audience is growing. They are working with practitioners, you know, ranchers, land managers across the globe, and their hub network is helping to serve as these nodes that are then educating and supporting practitioners in the given bioregion. So that being said, I think we need to very rapidly move beyond the model of landowner-operator. And, of course, a lot of ranchers have maybe not their own land, but they've had these long-term leases for a long time. But even that system, I would say, privileges those who have long-standing relationships in a given area or a lot of capital. We know that we need to be grazing a lot more land with a lot more animals in a management-intensive way, and so that's going to require a lot more people. So to me, the biggest bottleneck and barrier, it's not technology, it's not even money, it's just simply getting the people who are desperate to access land and who are capable of being sensitive stewards long-term, matched with land, matched with animals, so they can just get to work. This problem we have now of a lot of people excited about doing this, willing to dedicate the time to learn the skills, willing to learn stockmanship and willing to learn ecology, not being able to access the very tools through which they could be helping us reverse climate change so everybody can continue to live on this planet. You know, that's an absurd problem to have. It's just ridiculous and unnecessary. So that's, I think, what we need to start directing our attention to.
Well, I have interviewed Alan Savory, and I'll put a link to that interview in my Radio EcoShock blog at ecoshock.info. And you are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, and my guest is Ariel Greenwood. We're talking about agriculture, which can help restore the planet instead of damaging it. Ariel, there you are in the long-standing California drought. Are you pumping up groundwater to keep your cows alive?
Yeah, we are. And luckily, the land base we are on has a decent aquifer below it. And I'm fortunately, you know, to be partnered up with this guy who started this company, who is a water and infrastructure mastermind. So while I do all the day-to-day and a lot of the long-term planning, Aaron has been able to figure out how we can move water through gravity feeding, through, you know, portable poly pipes and solar panels across all of a 4,000-acre land base, including through, you know, two 500-foot deep canyons. So what that means is I can take the herd out and graze them at density and incredibly sensitively on foot as one operator and 150 animals in places where most people just turn their cattle out and let them either fend for themselves or poke around, overgraze and undergraze. So it's been challenging. You know, the drought affects our forage for sure. But the beautiful thing about this kind of grazing is the better you do it and the longer you do it, the more you are increasing soil health and the more you're increasing your effective rainfall. So, you know, the trend for a lot of holistically managed land bases globally is that they are increasing their stocking rates while all of their neighbors are culling or selling cattle because they just have more and more and more forage, more biomass to keep up with. And by virtue of, quote, keeping up with it, you are cycling that back into the soil. So it's an upward trend in a time when, you know, we're suffering from negative downward spirals globally. So it's a really beautiful process to be a part of.
A lucky time to be alive. You know, to be honest, Ariel Greenwood, your photos look more like a hip young city woman. How did you get involved as a cowgirl, if I could call you that?
Sure. Well, I've got you fooled. I grew up back in North Carolina, where I'm from, in the Southeast U.S. And I didn't even go to school until college, until university. And so most of my time was spent in the ratty rural wilds of my unsupervised land base. And I had horses and chickens and dogs and fishing poles and bikes and spent a lot of time just on my own pursuing my interests. And when I got a driver's license, I found a job at a farm that was a diversified, sustainable vegetable and perennial herb farm. So from there, I just incrementally was exposed to kind of the plight of our planet and the role of agriculture in that. And then in college, I studied psychology along with agroecology, which is a really helpful pairing. And so I could learn about the people systems, but also the ecological systems behind sort of our agricultural scene these days. And was exposed during that time to holistic management, to Alan Savory, to the role of managed ruminants and grassland ecosystems. And so while I was working part or full-time all through college, producing vegetables and fruit in different contexts, I was really getting very excited about the prospect of working with animals on a large land base. So eventually found my way to California and worked really hard to be paired up with a herd, which I now have been working with this herd of cattle on Pepperwood with Holistic Ag for almost 2 years. So it's been a winding path, but the longer I'm in it, the more I feel like it's the place to be. And I'm really excited about trying to play my part in bringing more and more people, young and old, to, you know, better relationships with land and animals, because we just so critically need more, you know, boots on the ground and hooves on the ground, as it were.
And speaking about that, in a past show, I talked with activists in the young farmer movement. I interviewed dirt farmer Severin von Scharner Fleming of Greenhorn Radio. Do you think there is a path for young people to get into producing honest food?
You know, it's hard to say if it's getting better or worse. People like Severin or my friend Evan Wigg out here with the Farmers Guild and many others have made it much more possible for people like me than would be the case were they not, you know, fighting tooth and nail for us to have access to land and capital. The trend that I see that I'd like to call attention to, though, is that, you know, the sort of pastoral or agrarian ideal is common and healthy. And so what happens is a lot of, especially in the Bay Area, but increasingly across the country, people make money in an industry that maybe is within their expertise or aptitude, but doesn't necessarily lend itself to the management of complex biological or social systems. So these people end up buying land, build a second house, or move into a spot and have notions of wanting to farm, don't really know what that means. Maybe they get in contact with an ambitious young farmer who doesn't know how to look out for themselves in these relationships, and they strike a deal. Everything goes great until the honeymoon period wanes, and people end up at each other's throats, even though they started with a beautiful vision of cooperative land management. So what I would say is we have the people who are desperate to access land and produce food ecologically for their communities and, you know, leave the planet better for it. But a lot of work needs to be done on the part of landowners to mature their understanding of how to work, how to enable people to be stewards on their land, how to make cooperative lease arrangements that are reasonable, how to invest in infrastructure and capital that is meaningful. And I would encourage any landowners who maybe identify with that to look at groups like the Farmers Guild, to look at groups like Greenhorns, and especially Agrarian Trust, which is a side project of Severin at Greenhorns. It's really working hard to help, again, mature the relationship between landowners and, you know, tenants or potential agricultural operators.
What's happening with the Eat Local movement in your area?
I mean, it's incredibly robust. And when I moved to Sonoma County here in Northern California, I didn't understand much about the place. I was relatively new to California. I was just looking to access animals and grassland. Now that I'm here, I feel extremely blessed to be in a place where people value the story behind food. And it's interesting, especially in the grass-fed scene, because, you know, everyone's off to the races to be able to produce grass-fed and especially grass-finished beef. But that's going to look very, you know, grass-fed beef finished on coastal pastures is different from grass-fed beef finished on inland, Myakama, Mediterranean, you know, more arid pastures like what I'm on. And so what I found is that with my fortunate market being the whole Bay Area, my beef isn't for everybody, but the story that I tell, that it's funding this kind of ecological work, that the flavor is incredible and everything that went into that animal comes from one land base, is really well received by enough people. What I will say, though, is that there tends to sometimes be this phenomenon of a false sense of sufficiency, and that people think, well, I go to Whole Foods and I buy a few things from a farmer I know, and that's good enough, and it gives me a pass to buy everything else, you know, according to what is convenient. You know, we don't organize our lives around food anymore. And I didn't used to either. I totally understand it. If you want to develop an appetite for not just the food stuff itself, but for the culture and the experience of food, it takes time. It takes, you know, omitting certain things from your lives so that you can have the time to fellowship with people around food, to play with food, experiment with food. But what I would encourage people to think about is that insofar as we have sort of a biological, evolutionary hardwiring for enjoyment, food is, it fits perfectly. It's a very efficient way to have fun and experience pleasure. And, you know, more importantly, perhaps a very efficient way to have a beneficial relationship with the planet at a time, you know, when we are in another mass extinction. So we all have a part to play, you know, and there's this quote that is oft repeated my circles, and it's a Wendell Berry quote that I like very much, and it's, eating is an agricultural act. But what I try to remind people is that eating is also an ecological act, because all of agriculture comes from soil, it comes from land, and that means ecology. So the more we equip ourselves to be naturalists, to be interested in our bioregion or the bioregion of where we're buying our food, the more we're able to have a meaningful and beneficial relationship with not just with farmland, but with nature as a whole. And that's sovereignty right there. You know, I can't imagine anything being really more deep down exciting than that. It's a very enlivening idea to a growing number of people.
I love what you just said. Why don't we wrap this up? Maybe you could just tell us a story of what your work can really be like out in the hills of California with the cows.
Sure. You know, it varies from day to day, month to month, and time of year. You know, some of the time I move the animals 1 to 3 times a day. Other times we practice something called backgrounding, which is sort of modified open turnout when the perennials aren't growing so they can't be overgrazed and when the animals could experience the most heat or metabolic stress. So we just kind of let them poke around on dormant grassland for a couple months and keep them out of areas they shouldn't be grazing. That's what I'm doing right now. But then next week I will be herding everybody together, bunching them up and taking them out into some pretty gnarly, steep grassland. It's a region called the Bald Hills and aptly named. And, you know, what I would remind people is that this is incredibly, it can be incredibly hard work, very rewarding and all that, but very hard. It's work that relies on, you know, management of resources across time. You have to hit your marks hour by hour for the whole system to sing in the way that it needs to. It can be physically incredibly taxing. You know, there's some of the areas I graze can't be accessed by really anyone besides four-legged cloven hoofed animal, and that does not include horses, or, you know, a two-legged mammal such as myself. There's just not much else besides, you know, smaller creatures and predators that can go out there. So I can't take an ATV there. I can't take a horse there. It's just me moving animals. You know, I do a lot of planning and mapping with Google Earth, which is a great, easy, free program for people to use for land management. And then I upload those files to Celeste Dodge, who is the systems ecologist here, and she takes all of our grazing data from the past 4 years, so including before I arrived on site, and creates a GIS spatial database that we can query and show our impact and our decision-making across time, and which is a really helpful tool because this really is a long game. Increasingly, I'm excited about the notion of community-supported grazing, and I'm just using that as sort of a catch-all term for grazing systems where some of the intense labor that just simply putting in time moving animals, whether herding or building fence, comes not just from single operators, but from the community, from people who are going to be the ones eating the beef, the product of that grassland. That's something that I don't know I'll be able to explore anytime super soon, but long-term, again, I think we need everybody having some relationship with grassland if they're in a bioregion that has grassland, and more of a relationship with animals. So I would love to share some of the burdensome aspects of my work with people who would enjoy that kind of physical and psychological stimulation. So that's kind of something I'm thinking about. But overall, it's a lot of exertion. It takes a lot of grit and focus, but it's very beautiful and very satisfying work. But it's certainly not for everybody.
From Pepperwood Preserve in Santa Rosa, California, we've been talking with the new modern herdist, Ariel Greenwood. I'll put links to Ariel's Facebook page and land blog in my own show blog at ecoshock.info, but you can go straight to her website at arielgreenwood.com. Her first name is spelled A-R-I-E-L. And Ariel, it has been a pleasure to have you on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. Same here, Alex. I enjoyed the conversation.
I'm Alex Smith reporting. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening to Radio EcoShock again this week. We'll close out with another climate performance piece from Bava Brinkman's new album, The Rapt Guide to Climate Chaos. Bava Brinkman has performed at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, on the Rachel Maddow Show, and at the Sydney Opera House, including a rap version of Shakespeare's Canterbury Tales. In 2014, he brought out the album Rapt Guide to the Wilderness. Now he's back with a new one, The Rap Guide to Climate Chaos. Couldn't be better timed. You can get 4 cuts off the new coming album at bandcamp.com. You can get them cheap. I'll put a link in my show blog at ecoshock.info. In this complex piece I'm going to play you called Carbon Bubble, Brinkman does what we all do. He agonizes over his own role, burning fossil fuels just to earn a living. But the piece is deeper than that. It calls out a caricature of what I would call the super carbon human.
Forgive me for producing some emissions and pollution, but this rhythm and the music is my living. When I do it, I get paid. Yeah, it's been a decade since I've had a day job, and I did it my way, like Frank Sinatra. I'm just kicking up a racket. I could be at a university teaching classes, but this is more fun than teaching. Look at the people I'm reaching. Been around the world. I fly to Europe for the weekend, do a gig in California before I fly to New Zealand. Encyclopedic Rolling Stone, pinch me, I'm dreaming. And you can check my status. Got a U.S. visa, 01, artist of extraordinary achievement. This is all I've ever wanted, baby, living the life. In the past 5 years, 150 flights, 15 countries, 40 states and provinces. And as for carbon emissions, I'm off the charts with it. Fossil fuel is how I got here, both to entertain you and in my career. If you're earning something, well then you're burning something. Prosperity is driven by internal combustion. Something holler back. We got Mother Nature on her back, but it's a one-time thing, never call her back. Hydrocarbons at both ends, burning to make money and burning to spend. And no one tells me how to dispose of my own property. A globe-trotting solo artist with total autonomy. This is what I am, fossil fuel is a part of me. It powers 80% of the global economy. In other words, if you have some money, it's got oil stains on it, your hands are bloody. And if you don't believe me, go ahead and do a study. Pimping ain't easy, you better ask somebody. Cooking with gas is pimping, driving a car is pimping, energy consumption is pimping. Look at how we're living gangster compared the horse and buggy days, cranking up the air conditioner on muggy days. You're not freezing to death in the winter. If energy consumption is a sin, I'm a sinner. Life is good, it's better than it used to be. Let the good times roll, fossil fuels are cheap. That's how we stay hella major. Prosperity is the bomb, player hater. Something holler back. We got Mother Nature on the back, but it's a one-time thing, never call her back. The lights conserve power. Everything goes dark. It's Earth hour. We're taking action on climate change. All together now. Back to the Stone Age. In the meantime, I'll be up in Vegas, illuminated, laughing at your player haters. Face it. Ballin' is part of our nature, embrace it. You love energy wasting. Would you rather be living large and comfortably, or in a shack burning dung for heat? Some people don't have a choice, but you do. So don't hit me with any hypocritical voodoo about trying to reduce my footprint voluntarily. I'm trying to make ends, I can't let them barely meet. I'm always trying to get more gigs and fly more. I got a wife and a daughter to provide for, and maybe one day solar will supply us. I hope so, it's better for global climate. Just don't make me choose between solar and diapers, and don't make me switch off my amplifiers.
Radio EcoShock, bright voices in dark times. Get more, ecoshock.info.
And we're back, it's a Taylor Report. should be speaking momentarily with Zafar Bengash, and I'm going to add a name now we will also be talking to Sarah Flounders of the International Action Committee. We're trying to get reactions to all of these recent events, particularly the bombing in eastern Syria and the noisy and unpleasant dispute going on at the Security Council. And Canada's going to have to – Canadians, I forget the government. It's not going to do a thing, but people should be very alert because now we have warplanes, just exactly what people talked about as danger of this matter of violating the airspace of the sovereign state of Syria in a cavalier manner. Without any, I mean, Denmark. Why? How does Denmark get off bombing Syria? It's ridiculous. And today, Australia says they were in on the bombing. By the way, and also there's argument about that maybe the U.S. is trying to spread a little responsibility or mislead. There's a lot of dispute about it. There's no question that the attack took place. There's no question that it aided and abetted ISIS. Everybody seems to agree that ISIS is a bad bunch of people. However, they have bombed strategically. It is an area of Syria where there's a base that is surrounded, and people are at risk, and it is where the Syrian army is located. And I think we're joined by Zafar Bengash, who can, I hope, affirm this. Are you there, Zafar?
Yes. Hello, Phil. I am, yes.
Crescent-international.net.
Yes.
Online.net. Yes. Now, Zafar, I was just introducing this by saying that this is turning into a very dangerous situation. The Security Council, we've seen Mr. Churkin and Samantha Power, as a result of a U.S. Attack inside Syria, in eastern Syria, at a very strategic place, which is, the Globe and Mail is using the word accident. Okay, so I guess I'm going to ask you, was that an accident? What happened?
Well, it could not be an accident at all because it is an air base, Deir ez-Zor, whose coordinates are well known to all of the parties involved in the Syrian conflict. So I cannot believe that this will be an accident or a mistake. This is also what Samantha Power said at the UN, the U.S. ambassador at the UN. But, you know, if this were, let's say, some bunker out in the middle of nowhere, then one could accept that this was a mistake or an accident. But here is an air base, well-known, whose coordinates are known to everybody. And four U.S. Air Force planes enter from Iraq, two F-16s and two A-10 jets. Mm-hmm. They come and they bomb this area, this air base, in which 62 Syrian soldiers are killed and more than 100 wounded. And what is also very interesting to note is that within 10 minutes of this U.S. attack on this airbase, the terrorist groups launched an attack in the surrounding mountains, and they captured a number of strategic heights that surround the airbase, particularly at Jabal Atardeh. Now, it seems awfully incredible that these terrorist groups would launch their operations within minutes of the U.S. Airstrike on a Syrian airbase.
Yes, and Zafar, could I stop you just there and say, if it were an accident, now they were, as a result, the ISIS people are taking the heights, where is the follow-up attack to kill the ISIS people?
Exactly. You see, now, the United States and Russia...
People who make a mess are supposed to clean them up.
Correct. This ceasefire agreement that was signed on September the 9th and went into effect on the evening of September the 12th. Based on that agreement, after marathon talks in Geneva between U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and the Russian Foreign Minister Sergey Lavrov, it was this particular agreement was to last for 7 days. And then on September the 14th, it was extended by another 48 hours. So 1 week plus another 48 hours so that, the ceasefire would take hold. It would give aid convoys to reach certain areas of Syria, etc. Instead, what the U.S. has done is to attack Syrian government positions and this is basically, there are two problems with this. Number one, Syria's sovereignty has been violated. Syria is an independent country, a sovereign state. The U.S. Air Force has and had no authority to enter Syrian airspace, although in the past it has continued to carry out these attacks. And secondly, they attacked a well-known airbase in that region, which, as I mentioned earlier, whose coordinates are well known to all of the parties, including the Americans. Mm-hmm. And as you pointed out, if that was a mistake, then surely these terrorist groups that were supposed to be the real target of these operations, why weren't they attacked?
Now would be the time to hit them.
Yeah, exactly. If they have taken up positions on top of mountains, as incidentally Russian and Syrian air forces did yesterday, they attacked these terrorist positions and ultimately drove them out of those mountain tops because if they had stayed there, they would pose a serious threat to that Syrian airbase as well as to the aircraft that take off and land at that airbase.
I'm very glad to hear you say that. As you know, this story seems to be kind of unfolding, and this is it is important to win this battle because they intend to capture that and run up the flag and be recognized and tear a piece of Syria away.
Well, that's exactly what these terrorists are doing. And one other point that I'd like to mention is that in the Geneva Agreement or the ceasefire agreement, what it said was that, quote-unquote, moderate Syrian rebels would not be targeted. One of the problems I have with this designation of these moderate Syrian rebels is that the terrorists simply change their name and then they reemerge under another label. And then they are presented as the moderates. Yeah. Simply changing names, whether it's Al-Qaeda or Al-Nusra or Ahrar al-Sham or Fateh al-Sham or all of these different verbal gymnastics that they indulge in, it is the same bunch of murderous thugs, killers, rapists, cannibals. Yes. And yet they, just by changing their name, they... the U.S. then says, oh, these are moderates and we
now,
should not be
apropos,
attacked.
I just read today that the new second-in-command of the ever-changing alphabet soup of terrorists is a Saudi national who was actually considered so bad that he was held for a while in a Saudi prison. But now he's been released and he is the number two man.
Well, this is not surprising at all. In fact, we have a document.
Sounds like the 911 bunch seem to be always in business.
Yes, exactly.
And America looks everywhere except in front of them.
You know, we have a document that was sent by the Saudi Interior Minister to the head of prisons. This is dated from 2012, in which the director of prisons in Saudi Arabia was told that he should release all of the criminals, convicted criminals, those that are in prison for murder or rapes or robberies, etc., and particularly those that are on death row, that in return for their release and support for their families, that they should take up arms and go to Syria. We have that document in our possession, mm-hmm. an official document of the Syrian Interior Ministry. Mm-hmm. Now, this is well known. We have published it in the Crescent magazine. And if anybody is interested, they could go to our website and have a look at that document. Yeah.
Crescent-online.net, right?
That's correct, yes. So that means that Saudi Arabia is deeply complicit in what is going on in Syria. Right from day one, the Saudi regime was involved in destabilizing and overthrowing the government of President Bashar al-Assad, and that the Saudis have not given up on this. They continue to send arms and money and these mercenaries from Saudi.
This is a life and death fight for them.
Absolutely.
I mean, they've started something which could finish off the Saudis.
Yes, of course. This is absolutely true.
Hallelujah.
These elements are definitely, there are a whole lot of them inside Saudi Arabia as well, and they definitely will pose a threat to the Saudi regime. Mm. And quite honestly, I would be very happy if they were to do that, because the Saudi regime has created a lot of problems.
Well, they're bombing Syria, bombing Yemen,
yes.
with the assistance of the British and Americans, who continue, by the way, this very cynical game where we have to go through the weeds of all their denials, when in fact it's plain as nose on their face what they're doing.
Exactly.
And by the way, a lot of people are being exposed, right? Now, Human Rights Watch, their leader, for example, he tweeted a comment which basically encouraged the idea, let's have more accidental bombings, because he thinks you're sending messages. Is Assad going to get the message? So why can't we just take Human Rights Watch off the table as anything representing integrity or honesty or fair dealing? It's actually an appendage of the Pentagon.
Well, this is one of the very tragic situations that we face in the world today, that many of these so-called human rights organizations are not really concerned about human rights. They're only interested in advancing U.S.-NATO agenda in whatever part of the world they may be. For instance, the U.N. Human Rights Council has called for an independent inquiry into the war crimes that the Saudi regime is committing in Yemen. Mm-hmm. And yet nobody pays any attention to that. Instead, the U.S., Britain, and other countries are involved in not only providing bombs and planes and helicopters, etc., to the Saudi regime, but they are also enforcing a blockade of Yemen in a similar fashion as Israel has blockaded the Gaza Strip. So there is a siege of the Gaza Strip by Israel, and there's a siege of Yemen by Saudi Arabia, the U.S., Britain, and a number of
so if that commission continued its work, you would find Canada and U.S. as culpable.
Yes,
culpable in the Saudi crimes.
Yes, absolutely.
But instead, we have to listen to Mr. Roth of the Human Rights Watch talking about Syria. Now, the one element I've got to make sure I ask you, I understand that Iraq has pointed out that those planes, U.S. planes, came from Iraq, but they say that this kind of thing has been going on for – someone in the Iraqi government said that they've been dropping weapons to the ISIS people. Have you heard these reports? I think they took the phone away from Zafar. Can you hear me, Zafar?
Yes, I can. We are on the cell phone, so I think sometimes it will cut off.
It's a good cell phone. You're coming through loud and clear. Is it – Iraq is certainly sympathetic to Syria's problems. I understand they are making comments about the way U.S. abuses its being presence in their country.
Yes, of course. You see, there are a number of not only – reports, but incidents in which U.S. planes have been dropping weapons to these ISIS or ISIL terrorists. In fact, in October of 2014, Iran's leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, in a conference said that we have evidence that the U.S. has provided or dropped weapons to these ISIS terrorists on five different occasions. Mm-hmm. Now, he said that if, let's say, the U.S. were to drop these weapons once and they said it was a mistake, we didn't want to supply these people but somebody else, and by mistake it went to these terrorists, then one could accept it. Mm-hmm. But five times dropping weapons to them is not a mistake. It's a policy, a calculated policy, and that is exactly what's happening.
Yeah, fool me once, as President Bush said. He couldn't remember how the rest of it went. Zafar, it's a pleasure talking to you, and you've shed an awful lot of light on the matter. We, of course, are going to need to talk to you again soon, because this thing is, in the next 3 or 4 days, it's going to be even more troubling. And so we'll come back to you. Thank you very, very much.
Sure. Thank you. It's my great pleasure.
Zafar Bengash, crescent-online.net. This is the Taylor Report, CIT 89.5 FM.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Trevor Tim, Executive Director of the Freedom of the Press Foundation, who discusses the campaign recently launched to persuade President Obama to issue a pardon to NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden. Hugh McMillan, Senior Researcher with Food and Water Watch, who summarizes the findings of his new report revealing the Wall Street banks financing the controversial Dakota Access Pipeline. And Pat Hines, director of the Trap Rock Center for Peace and Justice, who talks about how the military-industrial complex in the U.S. and in other nations around the world contribute to the urgent problem of climate change. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Philippines' newly elected president, Rodrigo Duterte, who has made a series of statements critical of the United States, has called for U.S. Special Forces to leave the southern island of Mindanao. U.S. Special Forces have operated in the southern Philippines since 2002, targeting the Abu Sayyaf Islamic insurgent group that has kidnapped and killed dozens of hostages. At its height, there were 1,200 U.S. troops in the southern Philippines, but that number is now down to 107, who are limited to conducting surveillance operations. In the days after the recent Association of Southeast Asian Nations summit in Laos, President Duterte rejected an agreement for dual naval patrols in the South China Sea. Duterte said the Philippines will limit patrols to its territorial waters. He also indicated the Philippines would, in the future, purchase weapons from Russia and China instead of its longtime ally and supplier, the U.S. In August, Duterte restarted peace talks with the 12,000-strong rebel Moro Islamic Liberation Front, who have fought for decades for an independent Islamic state on Mindanao. Combined with the pullback from the South China Sea, Duterte is moving away from the 1951 U.S.-Philippines Security Treaty, an important part of U.S. strategic security alliances in Southeast Asia. Alan Gross, a U.S. government subcontractor for the U.S. Agency for International Development, spent 5 years in a Havana jail after being convicted of providing Cuba's small Jewish community with internet communications equipment, including discrete SIM cards used to mask the signals of satellite phones that are generally restricted to military use. During his ordeal, Gross lost 110 pounds. Gross was released in December 2014 as part of the historic diplomatic negotiations that led to the thaw in U.S.-Cuba relations. Today, Gross remains a strong advocate of an open internet in Cuba, recently telling the El Nuevo Herald in Miami there are 11.3 million people who live on the island who should be furious at the government for not giving them internet access. According to the BBC, internet services remains spotty in Cuba. The government has set up 40 Wi-Fi hotspots in various cities, which offer expensive access to Facebook and Twitter, but block opposition websites. Gross, who now praises the work of President Obama and former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton for his release, told attendees at a recent conference that he became a catalyst in the U.S.-Cuba process of normalization, which he believes is irrepressible and positive. Far away from the confrontation over the Dakota Access Pipeline between the Standing Rock Sioux in North Dakota, their allies, and the company building the pipeline, Energy Transfer Partners, an earlier conflict between Texas oil company Western Refining and local opposition near Gallup, New Mexico, over an extension of a pipeline's right-of-way, illuminates the duplicitous role played by the Bureau of Indian Affairs, or BIA. The BIA was among those who pushed for an extension, and nationally manages 55 million acres in trust for Native peoples. A six-month investigation by Stephanie Woodard of In These Times magazine reveals that the BIA often makes it cheap and easy for outside corporations to exploit Native resources. As a result, corporations are able to drill, frack, farm, and fell timber on Native lands, paying landowners little in return. Big corporations like Koch Industries, Walmart, and Dollar General profit from exploiting Native resources. In 1989, a congressional report concluded Koch Oil engaged in premeditated theft by mismeasuring the oil taken from Native land. Today, Native communities are among the poorest places in the U.S., where average tribal income rarely exceeds $10,000 a year, and the unemployment rate exceeds 50%. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
A campaign to persuade President Obama that he should issue a presidential pardon to NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden was launched to coincide with the opening of Oscar-winning film director Oliver Stone's newest biopic movie, Snowden. The Pardon Snowden campaign, supported by the American Civil Liberties Union, Amnesty International, and Human Rights Watch, among other groups, is working to convince Mr. Obama that Snowden's act of whistleblowing benefited the United States and enriched democratic debate worldwide. The campaign is urging citizens to write the president and sign an online petition in support of the effort. Among the many public figures supporting a Snowden pardon are U.S. Senators Bernie Sanders and Rod Wyden, Vietnam War-era whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg, Professors Noam Chomsky, Cornel West, and Lawrence Lessig, current and former government officials, including Lawrence Wilkerson, former Chief of Staff to U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell, actor Susan Sarandon, and director Terry Gilliam. Those pressing for a pardon before President Obama leaves office on January 20, 2017, say that Snowden's selfless act revealing unconstitutional warrantless dragnet surveillance of all Americans' communications led to some necessary reforms and moves toward more government accountability. Your reporter spoke with Trevor Timm, executive director of the Freedom of the Press Foundation, whose board Edward Snowden chairs from exile in Russia. Here Timm talks about why he believes Snowden deserves a pardon and the need to protect whistleblowers and the journalists who tell their stories.
Edward Snowden, believe it or not, has kind of been a public figure for 3.5 years now. And what he revealed, you know, essentially the NSA's mass surveillance program, where the NSA was actually gathering up every single phone call record in the United States, whether you were man, woman, or child, innocent or guilty. This is billions and billions of calls per day. And this was happening without the public's knowledge whatsoever. And since Edward Snowden came forward, the Congress has passed the first intelligence reform in 40 years. The courts have ruled what Edward Snowden revealed to be illegal, and the NSA had to curtail its activities. And there's been really a sea change in the way that the public views online privacy today. And so for these reasons, we are asking people to support our petition at pardonsnowden.org, which essentially calls on President Obama to use his pardon power to pardon Edward Snowden before he leaves office. Right now, Edward Snowden, fortunately, is not in jail, though he faces criminal indictment. He has been exiled in Russia for the past 3 years. And we really want to create a situation where Edward Snowden can come home to the United States with dignity.
What's the most compelling argument of those like yourself who advocate a Snowden pardon? How do you make the case against the idea that Snowden, by his release of top-secret U.S. surveillance programs, endangered national security? Of course, this has been a running mantra of many in the national security state within the U.S. government, particularly conservative commentators across the country.
Of course, and I think it's a natural question that anybody asks, especially because what they've been hearing from government officials for the past 3 years. But actually, when you look at what the government has been saying closely, they can't actually point to a single piece of evidence or a single concrete harm that has come to the United States. You know, unfortunately, the government uses national security to hide all sorts of illegal programs from United States citizens. And in the past, when similar leaks have happened or the government is about to release reports on what the CIA or the NSA is doing, they often bring up national security and claim that it will be harmed. And time after time after time, they've shown to completely exaggerate or if not just make up those threats. So, for example, there was a House Intelligence Committee report that just came out, which talked, you know, a lot about national security, yet they still couldn't point to a single thing that Edward Snowden has done that has actually harmed United States citizens. But we do know all of the benefits that we've gotten from Edward Snowden, you know, the court cases and really a reinvigoration of democracy. The people now know that they can actually hold the government accountable for what they're doing behind closed doors under their name.
Well, Trevor, I also wanted to ask you about some of the work you're doing currently, both to protect whistleblowers and the journalists who tell their stories. There have been some very disturbing instances recently where the government has surveilled journalists about their work and connections with whistleblowers. There's also been cases where the government has recently attempted to prosecute journalists for telling the public government secrets that, in the mind of many, belong in the public domain. Tell us a bit about the work that you're doing on this score.
Yeah. You know, unfortunately, in the past 8 years under the Obama administration, there's been a record amount of whistleblowers prosecuted under the Espionage Act. And along with that, we've seen a huge increase in surveillance of journalists who are just reporting exactly what they're supposed to the American public. You know, there was a few incidents a few years ago that are fairly notorious at this point, where two Associated Press journalists were spied on by the government, a Fox News journalist. The same thing happened to the government was reading his email. One of the most famous Pulitzer Prize winning reporters in the country, New York Times reporter James Risen, almost faced jail because he was under subpoena for almost 7 years in an attempt to give up one of his sources. Even with President Obama promising to be the most transparent administration ever when he came into office, We have really seen an increase in the amount of surveillance that has happened to journalists. And so at Freedom of the Press Foundation, we lobby the government to provide extra protections to journalists. We sue the government under the Freedom of Information Act to release more information about what they're doing behind closed doors. And we develop technology that hopefully can protect journalists and whistleblowers when they're communicating online where the law falls short. In the past few years, we've seen a few successes on this front. You know, the government has kind of curtailed at least their most egregious acts that were happening in the first Obama term. But it's certainly a long road. And, you know, there are hundreds of other governments around the world who are intent on prosecuting and arresting and potentially killing journalists. So it's definitely a long fight.
That was Trevor Timm, Executive Director of the Freedom of the Press Foundation. Learn more about the Pardon Snowden campaign and the foundation by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In recent developments in the ongoing opposition campaign to stop construction of the Dakota Access oil pipeline in North Dakota, a federal appeals court in Washington, D.C. on September 16th ordered a temporary halt to construction of the 1,100-mile pipeline near the Missouri River, upstream from the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation. The stop work order is in effect until the court can rule on a preliminary injunction sought by the Standing Rock Tribe that was initially denied in federal court on September 9th. The tribe and their allies opposed the pipeline because of sacred burial sites in the area and the threat to its drinking water supply posed by a potential oil spill. Climate activists are working to block fossil fuel pipelines nationwide that contribute to global warming. Earlier on Labor Day weekend, security guards hired by the company building the pipeline, Energy Transfer Partners, pepper-sprayed and physically assaulted protesters using attack dogs who reportedly bit at least six people. Video of the violent confrontation was captured by journalist Amy Goodman and her Democracy Now! Film crew, which later went viral across the news media and internet. However, 5 days later, the state of North Dakota issued an arrest warrant for Goodman, charging her with criminal trespassing, a clear violation of the First Amendment. Your reporter spoke with Hugh McMillan, senior researcher with the group Food and Water Watch, who talks about his recent report titled, Who's Banking on the Dakota Access Pipeline? Here he details the Wall Street banks behind the project and their conflict of interest with indigenous communities and other people living along the pipeline route.
This pipeline, Dakota Access, is part of a larger project called the Bakken Pipeline, Bakken Crude Pipeline, being pushed by Energy Transfer Partners. Energy Transfer Partners and its affiliate, Sunoco Logistics, have been the driving force behind this project, and they're partnering with Phillips 66, Enbridge, and Marathon. Enbridge and Marathon just bought in about a month ago for $2 billion. Now, the full project would run from near the Canadian border on down to the Texas Gulf Coast. So Dakota Access running from North Dakota, 1,100 miles to southern Illinois, but it would connect with Energy Transfer Partners pipeline being converted to transport the oil farther, another 700 miles to Texas refineries and potentially also export facilities. Oil would also be sent from southern Illinois to the East Coast on what we've come to call bomb trains. There are 17 financial institutions, banks from all over the world, really, who loaned Dakota Access $2.5 billion for this Bakken pipeline project. And most of these banks and numerous others have also committed hundreds of millions each to the Energy Transfer family of companies to help these entities build out more oil and gas infrastructure, to support more fracking for oil and gas, and to support North American exports of oil and gas, all in the false name of energy security.
When you look at the profit motive here versus the utility and necessity from the point of view of these companies, at least their corporate line, that it's necessary for fossil fuel infrastructure, Where do you find the flaws in these arguments that this pipeline, as well as others in this network of pipelines, is necessary?
This project is really just a slice of a much larger fracking pie for these banks. Six banks alone, Wells Fargo, Bank of America, J.P. Morgan, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, and Citibank, they hold over $200 billion in oil and gas industry loans. And they've succeeded, these banks, working together with oil and gas companies, front groups, and think tanks. They've succeeded in establishing a U.S. energy policy that equates widespread fracking with energy security. Our executive director at Food and Water Watch calls this tangle of interest frackopoly. And the banks aim to get paid back through widespread drilling and fracking for decades to maximize oil and gas production. The place where we find flaws is that, this is coming at the expense of targeted communities and the stability of our climate. We've yet to align U.S. energy policy with the urgency of climate science. We still aim to maximize oil and gas production when science is clear. We must maximize what we keep in the ground.
Now, how does federal policy vis-a-vis the United States agreement at the Paris Climate Summit to trim back our contributions here in this country to carbon emissions and the like from fossil fuels, how does that line up with these major fracking projects in places like North Dakota?
Well, there's a real disconnect, frankly. The DOE, a year ago, it published its quadrennial technology review. This document was billed as one that examines the current status of clean energy technologies in a chapter titled Advancing Clean Energy Technologies. Permeability manipulation is the agency's preferred name for fracking, and that's given it as an example of an area where improvements can lead toward what the DOE calls a mastery of the subsurface. Now, the DOE is anticipating having this mastery of the subsurface and being able to create negative emissions by capturing carbon dioxide and pumping it under the ground. You know, I think this is a fool's errand. True energy security will only come when we're meeting our energy needs without destabilizing the climate and without sacrificing people's health and welfare along the way.
That was Hugh McMillan, senior researcher with Food and Water Watch. Find a link to his report, Who's Banking on the Dakota Access Pipeline, and related articles by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Former presidential candidate and Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders called climate change the most urgent threat to national security. But most government officials and most peace activists don't necessarily make the connection between the havoc that the climate crisis is already creating and will create in the future and the issues of peace and security. One glaring example is the drought in Syria, which pushed tens of thousands of Syrians off their land and into the cities, exacerbating conflicts which precipitated the civil war that has raged for the past 5.5 years, killing up to 500,000 Syrians and displacing millions more. One group that does make that connection is the Trap Rock Center for Peace and Justice in Greenfield, Massachusetts. The center's director, Pat Hines, spoke earlier this month to a meeting in Connecticut that was co-sponsored by the groups Promoting Enduring Peace and the Connecticut chapter of 350.org, which brought peace and climate activists together. Hines is a retired professor of urban environmental health and has worked for decades as an educator, researcher, writer, and activist on issues of environmental justice, feminism, and the health effects of war. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Hines about how resources dedicated to the military in the U.S. and other nations around the world contributes to the urgent crisis of climate change.
The U.S. military is the largest institutional user of oil in the world, and it is the largest institutional contributor to climate change. The key book, which came out a few years ago, called The Green Zone by Barry Sanders, is probably the only book thus far written by an author who has tried to ferret out documentation in terms of the amount of oil used by the Pentagon. His conclusion is that the Pentagon contributes 5% of emissions to climate change, and no other institution contributes 5% of the global emissions to climate change. His analysis does not include the NATO nations, for example, which our government badgers consistently to contribute to build up their contribution of military budget to NATO, so pushing countries to build their military budgets to be equivalent to 2% of their country budgets. And that means they, too, scaling up with respect to all of these military planes, tanks, ships, and the manufacture, the testing of them in war games, et cetera. All of this contributing more in terms of militarization and warming. And then also the new Cold War tensions, which the military historian Michael Clare has written about recently, among what he calls the great powers, those being the U.S., China, and Russia. So the new Cold War tensions among these great powers, which then causes the buildup of militaries in all of these countries, plus war games with Asian partners in our pivot to Asia to surround China. And just to give an example from one war that we have conducted, this is information which Oil Change International, that is a research group, has collected and put together. The full cost of the Iraq War, which have been estimated to be about $3 trillion, that money have covered all of the global investments in renewable power generation needed between the time they did the report around 2007 through 2030 to reverse global warming trends. So another point about militarism and war and climate change is the trade-off point. If you are dedicating 52% of your discretionary budget, as we are doing in the United States, to the Pentagon and to all of the activities I've talked about, that is the military-industrial complex as well, if we are dedicating that money, that percent of our budget, we are then taking it away from all of the other aspects of the discretionary budget, health, education, welfare, housing, environmental protection, climate change research, transportation, etc. Another piece that they have done as a way of analysis in terms of militarism being an engine of climate change is that rebuilding Iraqi schools, homes, businesses, bridges, roads, and hospitals polarized by the war, as well as new security walls and barriers, would require millions of tons of cement. Cement is one of the largest industrial sources of greenhouse gas emissions.
Patricia Hines, there's been a lot written about how the Pentagon is such a big promoter within the federal government of the need to address climate change and that it's taking the lead in that regard.
First, the greening of the Pentagon, I would compare to a whitened sepulcher. There is nothing that they can do that can possibly affect the great damage that so much of our resources dedicated to militarism and war do. That said, most of the greening of the Pentagon would encompass putting solar, wind into bases that they have for electricity and research on alternative fuels.
You said in your talk that you address groups concerned about peace and groups concerned about climate change, but you rarely address a group that's concerned about both.
I think we'd make much faster progress and more progress if we brought them together. As someone in the audience said as I was speaking, we work politically in silos. And so I think there's much more power in grassroots groups working in partnership together, which does not mean that we all do the same thing. It's that we support each other's issues, we continue to make the connections between them and build bridges between them so that we have a larger and larger base of activism against war and on behalf of mitigating climate change and becoming a renewable country.
That was Patricia Hines, director of the Trap Rock Center for Peace and Justice. Learn more about the work being done at the Trap Rock Center by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. And support our show, which is celebrating 25 years on the air in 2016. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Issued a decision as rare as it was remarkable. It overturned a decision by the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, strongly rebuked that court's former Chief Justice, and issued a new rule of constitutional law that no judge that formerly worked as a prosecutor could ever later sit as a judge examining his previous prosecutorial role. The reasons were many, but it boiled down to this single principle, that no man should be a judge of his own case. In the Williams case, the Supremes determined that Ronald Castillo, Philadelphia's former DA, should have recused or excused himself from sitting as a member of an appellate court, reviewing a decision by a lower court, which had determined that his former colleagues had hid evidence, sanitized witness statements, and presented an untrue picture of the case to the jury. What makes this case especially egregious is that this was a capital case, a death penalty case. Left unsaid were several important questions. For example, what happens to the DAs who hid or sanitized evidence? What happens to the other judges who, as justices of a state Supreme Court, looked on as Chief Justice Castillo violated the rights of fundamental fairness, not to mention constitutional due process rights, of the accused? Well, nothing. Nothing at all. When cops violate laws or rules, the media calls for more training, or lately, body cams. What about DAs, people already trained in law? What about justices or judges who see such violations and say nothing, or worse still, join in and vote to deny relief? Nothing. Nothing at all. That's the nature of the system. Like popes on the thrones of Rome, they can do no wrong until they do. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. Again, a cop arrives on a scene. An order is barked or oinked, and in a flash, a person is dead. More than likely, a dark person, a black person. Immediately, the language of depersonalization used by cops and the media snaps into place. Suspect, not person, suspect. And the crime? He did not comply. She didn't obey when I ordered her to put out her cigarette. Death for disobedience. Comply or die. Get on the ground, because you're a suspect. Suspected of what? It doesn't matter. Anything will do. You are not free to say no. You are not free. You are not. Like two-bit Nazis, cops make decisions like this every day, day after day after day. The dead die, families cry, and nothing happens. Because nobody died. Another dark soul died in America, you know, the land of the free. Nobody. Just a suspect. Just a nigger. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. freed from the hole. On the white card above his cell door, the name Arthur Johnson is neatly typed, followed by his prison number. Johnson has been held in solitary confinement in half a dozen Pennsylvania prisons since 1979, late December, when he unsuccessfully tried to escape. When he tried to escape, Jimmy Carter was president. Dustin Hoffman and Meryl Streep won Oscars for Kramer versus Kramer. And a beaming Sally Field won one for her portrayal of a heroic union organizer, Norma Rae. Newspaper headlines blared about an accident at a nuclear power plant in Pennsylvania, known as Three Mile Island. From that date to this, Arthur, known to his fellow prisoners as Chetawale, the name of an African Zulu warrior, has been in solitary confinement over 36, going on 37 years this coming December. Several days ago, a federal judge in central Pennsylvania ruled that Johnson's endless isolation was unconstitutional and ordered he be released into general population. Chief Judge Christopher C. Connor of Pennsylvania's Middle District issued an extraordinary preliminary injunction against the Department of Corrections, writing in his 26-page memorandum opinion the following. For the past 36 years, the department has held Mr. Johnson in solitary confinement, his entire existence restricted for at least 23 hours per day to an area smaller than a horse stall. Astoundingly, Mr. Johnson continues to endure this compounding punishment despite the complete absence of major disciplinary infractions for more than a quarter century. Judge Connor, Arthur Chetawale Johnson's long night of cruel and quite unusual treatment is finally coming to an end. It is a stark indictment of the DOC and its Kafkaesque cruelties committed under the rubric of corrections, solitary, isolation, the whole, for 36 years. Why? Because they could, period. They are the state. When the judge asked the state about the mental effects of such long-term confinement on Johnson, the DOC said he was okay because he had a window to see the cages in the prison yard. I kid you not. But perhaps the final word belongs to Chief Judge Connor, who wrote at opinion's end, after 36 years of isolation, Mr. Johnson deserves the opportunity to shake hands with someone other than his attorneys. Arthur Chetawale Johnson was represented in this civil rights trial by Brett Grote, Esquire, and Pittsburgh's Abolitionist Law Center. From Imprison Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
What did federal government agencies like the EPA actually know about the risks associated with breathing the air in and around the World Trade Center's site following the attacks of September 11, 2001? Why would local individuals and school boards allow children to be put in danger from predictably adverse environmental conditions? Were there criminal motives for suppressing information regarding the toxic materials from the Trade Center debris in the air and water around Ground Zero? And what are we to make of the legacy of the now deceased investigative journalist Michael Rupert? How significant were his contributions to 9/11 Truth, and how did he connect that evidence with his convictions about peak oil and global collapse? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we continue our special 15th anniversary look at 9/11 by interviewing New York-based author Jenna Orkin about her activism around 9/11 and her association with prominent 9/11 truth icon Michael Rupert. On this week's program, 9/11 Truth 15 Years Later, Jenna Orkin on EPA Lives and the legacy of 9/11 investigator Michael Rupert. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of September 23rd, 2016. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. As the U.S. heaps blame and accusations on Russia and Syria for the alleged airstrike on the aid convoy on Monday, the 19th of September, as ever, there are more questions than answers, and whatever U.S. spokespersons state, absolutely no certainties. The Russian Defense Ministry has categorically denied any attack and claims the convoy caught fire. Quote, "We have studied video footage from the scene from so-called activists in detail and did not find any evidence that the convoy had been struck by ordnance," unquote, commented Igor Konashenkov, a ministry spokesman. His observations are hard to challenge. Anyone who has studied the assaults of the international community, quote-unquote, on faraway countries over the last decades knows what a bombed truck looks like, what fragments remains of it. Konashenkov said that damage visible in footage was instead the result of cargo igniting, oddly occurring at the same time as militants, formerly Nusra Front, had started a big offensive in nearby Aleppo, backed by tanks, artillery, and other heavy equipment. That comes from the article, "Syria, Attack on Aid Convoy Kills 20, Destroys Aid, and Obliterates U.S. War Crimes in Support of ISIS-Daesh Terror Group," by Felicity Arbuthnot, posted September 21st. A Syria Red Crescent Society aid convoy, reportedly 10 to 20 trucks, was at Urem al-Kubra, allegedly destroyed by an airstrike in western Aleppo, according to pro-militant sources. There are conflicting reports about the movement of convoy. Western media say that the convoy was heading from the government-controlled western Aleppo, while the purpose of such a direction remains unclear. Other reports indicate that the convoy was heading from the countryside of Idlib to northern Aleppo, carrying weapons and ammunition for terrorists in the area. Whether this was a humanitarian convoy or not, this incident indicates a new rung on the escalation ladder and will be used by the U.S.-backed militant groups and Washington to prove that they were not responsible for the collapse of cessation of hostilities in Syria. That comes from the article, "Video: Contradictory Reports Regarding Humanitarian Convoy Destroyed on Road Near Aleppo," posted September 21st, originally appearing at South Front.
The Western terrorists are violating Syrians and the civilization that they represent each and every time they bomb innocent people. This country is being violated by terrorists who destroy history and people. Those who think differently or practice a different religion or refuse to switch religions or happen to be in proximity of a mortar bomb are deemed unimportant. Recently, protesters were protesting peacefully in a terrorist-occupied area, and the terrorists murdered them. These are the quote-unquote rebels, the quote-unquote freedom fighters, the quote-unquote moderates that the West supports. That comes from the article, Voices from Syria. This country is being violated by terrorists who destroy history and people, by Mark Taliano, posted September 21st. Right from the beginning of the Kashmir conflict 69 years ago, many commentators from Kashmir, other parts of India and Pakistan, and indeed from other countries, have argued that a peaceful solution must be built around a free and fair plebiscite that would allow the people of Kashmir to determine their own future. Self-determination, then, is the key to ending the conflict in Kashmir. This was the position adopted by the United Nations itself in 1949. At that time, the people of Kashmir, it was felt, should be allowed to choose between joining India or Pakistan. Today, however, it is obvious that Kashmiris should be given a third choice of establishing their own independent sovereign state that is not a part of either their two neighbors. That comes from the article, Kashmir, We the People Should Stand Up, by Chandra Muzaffar, posted September 21st. The tensions between those engaged in the dangerous and compromising pursuit of whistleblowing and those who use the fruit of such efforts has been all too coarsely revealed in the Washington Post stance on Edward Snowden. In taking its boggling stance, the Post's myopic editorial refuses to deem such interception programs as PRISM threatening to privacy, though it does concede that one all-hoovering metadata program, quote, was a stretch, if not an outright violation of federal surveillance law and posed risks to privacy, unquote. Something they can never forgive Snowden for is how his information revealed, quote, leaked details of basically defensible international operations, cooperation with Scandinavian services against Russia, spying on the wife of an Osama bin Laden associate, and certain cyber operations in China, unquote. This position, one effectively calling for the prosecution of the paper's own source, goes totally against the effusive defense of Snowden run in the same publication by media columnist Margaret Sullivan. As Glenn Greenwald reminded readers in The Intercept, the move was distinctly peculiar, coming from a publication owing, quote, its sources duties of protection and which, by virtue of accepting the source's materials and then publishing them, implicitly declares that the source's information to be in the public interest, unquote. That comes from the article, The Washington Post and Edward Snowden, by Dr. Binoy Campmark, posted September 21st. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. We continue our 15th anniversary retrospective look on the 9/11 attacks with a look at one of the less talked about aspects of the crime, namely what government agencies knew about air quality around and beyond the World Trade Center site once the buildings came down. The World Trade Center Health Program was established in 2011 to provide medical monitoring and treatment to those responders at the World Trade Center and related sites in New York, Shanksville, and the Pentagon, as well as to survivors in the New York City disaster area. According to an article in The Guardian, of the 75,000 people registered with WTCHP, 37,000 are suffering from serious respiratory or digestive illnesses, cancer, or a combination. 1,140 have already died. A September 11th article in The Guardian citing experts asserted, quote, the death toll among those sickened by the toxic dust and ash of Ground Zero will, within as little as 5 years, exceed the number of people killed on the day of the 9/11 attacks.
unquote. In the 15th anniversary retrospectives that appeared earlier in the month in major media, there have been references to increased illnesses and deaths stemming from exposure to Trade Center dust, but a casual inspection of North American media reveals little discussion of existing health and safety standards and protocols and scientific information being deliberately ignored, thereby contributing to the tragedy. Among the citizens who spearheaded the campaign to confront the EPA about the needless loss of life springing from its messaging was Jenna Orkin. Jenna Orkin is the co-founder of the World Trade Center Environmental Organization and other Lower Manhattan organizations that uncovered and testified to the lies of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency following 9/11 and resulting needless exposure of hundreds of thousands of people to record levels of contamination. Ms. Orkin is also the author of Scout, a memoir of investigative journalist Michael C. Rupert, as well as of the book The Moron's Guide to Global Collapse. She joins us now by phone from her home in Manhattan. Jenna Orkin, it is a privilege and an honor to have you finally on our program. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Michael.
Now, I was wondering, just to start, if you might briefly be willing to recount some of your own personal experiences on that morning of 9/11 when those traumatic events were playing out. What were you doing, and how did your experiences turn you into what I mean in a very complimentary way as a kind of crusader for 9/11 justice?
All right. So, you know, you gave a wonderful introduction. I want to point something out. There have been over 1,000 deaths so far, and they're expecting in 5 years for that number to exceed the number on 9/11, which means over 3,000, which means they expect a tripling in 5 years. So what that tells you is that there's an anticipation of the bell-shaped curve taking on form. So the number of illnesses and deaths are going to increase geometrically, if not exponentially, because of the incubation periods. In other words, the cancer has, you know, different cancers have different incubation periods, and some are very long. So we've only seen the tip of the iceberg thus far. Now, what was I doing that day? So around 8:45, I was on my way to the gym. I hear a big explosion across the water. So it sounds very distant. It's not the first time you've heard something like that. And I thought, okay, a gas explosion. Thought nothing more. Then a neighbor standing at the elevator said, did you hear about the World Trade Center? A plane flew into it. They think it's terrorists. And I looked out the window and I saw the smoke coming towards us. It was otherwise an absolutely perfect day. Change of plan. Go back indoors, call my son's school because he was at school four blocks north of Ground Zero at Stuyvesant High School. The line was busy. It remained busy. Called my ex-husband who worked down there to see if he could get our son. And I called him several times that morning, and the first time I called him, he had to get off. He said, I just watched somebody jump out the 90th story. That was the first time I ever heard about that happening. And then the second time I called him, somewhat later, there was a woman screaming in the background, and that was the time that the first building collapsed. In between, I kept trying to call the school, and finally my son reached me. But I was also trying to get to the school, which wasn't possible. They closed the subways and they closed the bridges. So then I was back home. My son called and they had evacuated the school by that time. When the plane first hit, my son had been in physics class and everybody looked out the window and the physics teacher, in a gesture that I consider emblematic of the attitude of many of the teachers down there for the next several months, closed the blinds. Went on with life as usual. And one of my students later said when I told him this, perhaps he was illustrating the quantum mechanics theory that a thing is both there and not there at the same time. Anyway, so there was a lot of, you know, burying the head in the sand. The FBI showed up at the school and told the principal to keep everybody indoors. The principal said, what are the chances the buildings could collapse? And the FBI agent said, not a chance. Then when the first building collapsed, the FBI agent told the principal there's a chance that the vibrations could bring down the school building, so get everybody out. So they evacuated 3,200 kids, 200 at a time, through two doors. And that's when I got the call from my son. He was heading up West Street, and he was using his teacher's cell phone, because in those days, kids didn't carry cell phones for the most part. And he walked 5 miles carrying a very heavy backpack because he hadn't gotten his gear in together to get a locker, and 26-pound backpack with the books in it. And he walked 5 miles. Eventually, a friend of mine picked him up at somebody's house because when the kids left the school, one of the administrators downstairs said, you know, see that person to your right or your left? That's your buddy. I don't care if you know them or not. You know, spot each other, run. So they just ran. And my son later wrote for English class, apart from the cloud coming at us, it was great run for your life weather. So anyway, they went to somebody's house, cleaned up. He insists he was not caught in the cloud. I cannot believe him. And then a friend of mine picked him up and took him to lunch, and where my ex-husband picked him up. So on the way there, they saw a woman crying, and at lunch my son said, do you know why she was crying? Because he'd overheard her. And my friend said no, and he said, she missed her train. If she'd been on that train, she would have been in the building. So anyway, I got involved in the environmental issue because of my son's attendance at that school, and there was a rush to return them back. If you remember, it was a very flag-waving time, and you've got to show the terrorists, and you've got to get back up on the horse. And so even among the parents at the school, the vast majority were applauding at the school that the kids had been taken to for several weeks, and applauding at the notion of getting back into the building as soon as possible. And I was pretty appalled. And there were very few people who agreed with me, but I made friends with them as soon as they, you know, showed themselves. And so, you know, we got each other's emails. The problem at that time was that data were being suppressed. So despite all one's suspicions and well-grounded suspicions, one couldn't prove anything, and one was not a PhD in environmental science, and so people did not listen to one at all. One was considered a hysterical mother. So, you know, that's the beginning of the story.
Maybe we could just mention a few of the specific concerns that you what was in the air?
Okay, what was in the air? First of all, it smelled awful. And even Giuliani, whose name I even feel a little nauseous saying, said, you know, boy, it's amazing because it really smells bad, but the government says it's okay. So isn't that great news? And within a couple of days, Christy Todd Whitman of the Environmental Protection Agency was saying, good news for New York. The air is safe to breathe and the water is safe to drink. Hallelujah. And people believed them. People believed in authority in those days. And I think if anything has been a result of this, it's that people are a little more skeptical of authority. Well, okay. But not only was the government saying it, but the media were parroting it. And even doctors were parroting it. So the New York Times came out with articles quoting doctors saying, temporary, it'll go away, don't worry about it, drink lots of water. I mean, I actually remember that quotation. Just drink a lot of water if you get dehydrated. If you're particularly sensitive or elderly or have a heart condition, then monitor your actions, your activity, and everybody else should be fine. And they consistently stood by that policy. So when they told people to clean up their apartments using a wet mop or a wet rag, where the dust is really bad, wear long pants. And insurance companies wouldn't clean it up because the government said it was safe. So residents went back into their apartments. Now, they're supposed to use a wet mop and a wet rag. Some of them had no water, but the government didn't seem to know that. I knew people who climbed 12 stories with plastic bags, filled them up, brought them down, went up again, and cleaned their apartments themselves, taking out literally tons of garbage, and have been sick ever since as a result. So, you know, that's crime number one. Now, what was in the air? All right, 50,000 computers, I believe that's just World Trade Centers 1 and 2, let alone, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7. 50,000 computers, each made with over 4 pounds of lead. Then you had asbestos, hundreds of tons of asbestos coating the first 40 stories of at least of one tower. It became illegal to use asbestos after, I believe, 1971, because it was toxic to the workers, so they stopped using it. But that's a lot of asbestos. Now, we'll get back to the other contaminants, but let me deal with their lies about that. The government has different ways of lying, and one of the tricks is to watch them metamorphose. As soon as you catch them on one lie, they maneuver to the next one. They give up that one. They'll even grant you, you know, victory there, and they'll go on to a new lie. You have to watch out for that. So what they did with asbestos was use antiquated equipment, and this came out in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch in January of 2002. Dr. Kate Jenkins, a chemist at EPA, a whistleblower, said that they were using 20-year-old equipment. For every fiber of asbestos that EPA found, independent contractors found 9. So the risk of cancer from the asbestos alone was 1 person in 10. Later on, they would do other little, you know, Machiavellian maneuvers with equipment. They would, in their cleanup, they would use fans to test, which was part of the protocol, but they wouldn't turn on the fans or the fan would be facing the wall. You don't know these things unless you're there. They never report this stuff. The way they lied about the alkalinity of the air was to reduce the number to under 11.5, I think it is, because that was a kind of a threshold level for causticity to humans. And so when you reduce it by 1, let's say from 12 to 11, it sounds like an inconsequential change, but it's not, because it's a logarithmic scale, so that it's not a change of approximately 9 or 10%. It's a change of an order of magnitude, a multiple of 10. In the New York Times accounts of this, they never tell you that. They just say they, you know, changed it from this number to that number, and you think, oh, all right, they corrected them.
It's like the seismic readings, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I believe that's correct, yes. So that was what they did about alkalinity, and in fact, the alkalinity of the air was equivalent to Drano, and within human tissues, it has, you know, a certain effect. So we did asbestos, we did alkalinity, we did lead. Then there's dioxin, which reached record levels, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, PAHs, polychlorinated biphenyls, PCBs, all record levels. Then another way that they managed to lie was simply by not conducting tests at all. For example, with very ultrafine particles, Dr. Thomas Cahill of the University of California, Davis, found the highest levels of any tests he conducted around the world, including at the burning Kuwaiti oil fields. 7,000 samples around the world, and we beat them all. The EPA simply didn't test for them. No tests at all, so that's why they didn't find any. So, and the other thing was that they focused almost exclusively in those days on asbestos. We're not finding asbestos, hooray. They would test in places where they knew they wouldn't find it. They would test in places that had been cleaned. They would test on vertical rather than horizontal surfaces. They wouldn't test the ventilation systems. And they did this year after year. When it was being brought up to them, they would, you know, listen and nod, and then at the next meeting they would do it again. And you would always get new reporters who had no idea, or new scientists from out of town, because there were scientific conferences held on this, and each new batch of scientists had to be re-educated. We had at least 3 major scientific conferences regarding the cleanup with different people whom the public educated, not the EPA.
I feel compelled at this point to just bring up an article in The Guardian that came up. It was an interview with Christine Todd Whitman. You're probably familiar with it, in which she was quoted as saying, apparently for the first time, "I'm very sorry that people are sick. I'm very sorry that people are dying. And if the EPA and I in any way contributed to that, I'm sorry. We did the very best we could at the time." And then she added, "Every time it comes around to the anniversary, I cringe because I know people will bring up my name, they blame me, they say that I lied, and that people died because I lied. People have died because I made a mistake," unquote. So the former EPA head essentially saying she admitted that she was mistaken in her messaging, but she denied that she deliberately lied to the public. Your response?
She's lying now. She's doing what she... I mean, what do you expect her to do at this point? She can't hide it anymore. People are too sick. The numbers are against her. She's got to do something. So she says she gives you the minimal. So, you know, my blood pressure can only take so much. It's meaningless.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What can you say then about the role of the White House Committee on Environmental Quality?
The White House Council on Environmental Quality. Let me tell you, can we go back to the school for a minute?
Absolutely, yes.
All right, because there are some interesting things that happened. The garbage was brought to the school. The World Trade Center debris was brought to a barge at the school and then from there taken to Staten Island and from there either buried in Freshkill, Staten Island, or it would be sent to China, Korea, and India as far away as possible. We were protesting about the placement of the barge because it was in violation of laws at every level of government. And we thought that we might have a chance of getting rid of the barge because Senator Schumer's daughter went to the school. You would think that he would want to protect her, but Schumer didn't. His wife was the, I forget if you call it chair or whatever, but she was the head of the Department of Transportation, which put the barge there. So the barge stayed for the 8 months of cleanup. That was number one. And the other thing I wanted to say was that the Chancellor of Schools, Harold Levy, was saying, you know, the air is safe, and when he was asked by the media, well, parents are a little concerned about it, because by that time they were, he said, parents should be concerned about whether or not their children are wearing seatbelts or having sex, he said. And then, to prove that it was safe, he moved his office for a week to the Stuyvesant School building. So that made the news. You know, Chancellor proves the air is safe. And one girl went to him and said, I'm not so sure, and I'm not comfortable being here. And he said, well, if you transfer out of the school now, you can't come back. So she stayed. After a week, he left. And she, by February, had something called pseudotumor cerebri, which is not the same as a real tumor, I gather. But it was a buildup of fluid pressure in her brain, and she had to have a spinal tap. Just wanted to get that in. So now, the Council on Environmental Quality. Well, he hasn't apologized. James Conaton, who manipulated at least one of EPA's press releases, changing cautionary statements about asbestos to reassurances, not a word out of him. So criminal though Christy Todd Whitman is, she's also a kind of fall guy for Conaton, for whatever that's worth. We know that they changed at least one of the press releases. And Conaton is also behind similar maneuvers with respect to climate change. Conaton's a very interesting figure, a dark horse, you know, one of Cheney's henchmen. And there's somebody I'd like to see prosecuted. Mm. You know, I thought of some more contaminants that I wanted to say, because it's important to get this in. There were thousands of contaminants, including radioactive americium-241 from the smoke detectors. And the government, in saying, you know, this level is safe, that level is safe, first of all, they were lying about that. But second of all, they did not take into account the additive effects, much less the synergistic effects, which is how they interact. And that can be very explosive. For example, if you're an asbestos worker and a smoker, it's not simply twice as bad as one exposure or the other. It's 80 or 90 times as bad. That's the effect of synergy, and they just didn't deal with it at all.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. Procedures that would normally be in place to when you have some sort of an environmental disaster, it sounds like this isn't just a question of incompetence. I mean, they're deliberately changing the protocols, like you mentioned,
absolutely,
in order to well, they're compromising the health of the citizens in order to protect what exactly? I don't know. They just what is it? Just some sort of an unprecedented situation? So they had to change.
Well, the thing is, they kept saying it was unprecedented. It was not. They're in the business of dealing with environmental disasters. Each one is unique, but there are parallel patterns, and they knew that. And you're quite right that, in a sense, 9/11 was used precisely to overturn precedent, because typically in an environmental disaster, you do representative testing in concentric circles from ground zero, wherever that is. And then you find the direction that the contaminants went in, and you clean up in that direction, and it makes sense, and it works, and they didn't do it for us. And we kept arguing for it, and they would dither and sort of play Magister Ludi. They would play a little medieval kind of game, like counting the angels on the head of a pin. They would say, well, what should be the fingerprint that we look for, a World Trade Center fingerprint? Well, there really couldn't be a fingerprint. It's the wrong metaphor, because the contaminants were released at different times. So if you're burning a computer, it's different from burning an X-ray machine and different from burning, you know, the stoves that were in the cafeterias. They release different contaminants. And so they would find slag wool in one place, and they would find, you know, asbestos elsewhere. So they kept, for years, toying with the idea that there was a fingerprint and not being able to decide on what it was, and so then all the conferences just went up in smoke.
You brought up that great, what you call emblematic maneuver of shutting the blinds to the window,
yeah.
The physics teacher did. So that suggests that there's a psychological component, but then there's the component of actual criminality. In other words, who might have the motive to change these policies? Like, what would the motive be, and who would benefit? So I maybe we can just sort of deal with each in turn, the psychological dimension. You had to fight with the Board of Education,
right?
Your parents, in order to protect children from these effects.
I'm not going to play therapist to the Board of Education, but I believe that they were kowtowing to the federal government, and they were being told what to say. They were being told it was safe, and they knew that they were supposed, the principal of Stuyvesant actually said at one point, I'm a soldier of the Board of Ed. I think they all felt like soldiers, and you can call it patriotism, but they knew what they had to do to keep their jobs. Now, you're talking about who has the motive to overturn precedent. So 9/11 was used to change protocols, to change precedent. And one of the ways it was used was that the standard for cleanup prior to 9/11 was one person in a million could be exposed to a contaminant, could get cancer from a particular contaminant after a cleanup. There would be one extra cancer per million. That was the standard prior to 9/11. After 9/11, it was one person in 10,000. That is 100 times as many people were allowed to get cancer from any one particular contaminant. And as we said before, there were thousands of contaminants. So if you're going to clean up and you find so much of dioxin, which is one of the most toxic substances known to man, and you find so much PAHs and all the others, the standard for each one is one person in 10,000. And I believe it was the New York Times, but the media posted a statistic that anti-nuclear activists were citing, which is that the government was now saying, one in 10,000 people can get cancer from radiation. So in other words, the standard became much more lax for cleanup subsequent to 9/11, and that made it a lot easier for any future environmental disasters, such as after BP.
Or Katrina,
yes. You don't have to clean up nearly as scrupulously as you would have had to before. So it makes everything much easier.
And I guess it would benefit the insurance companies?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Or anybody else who's, called upon to do it.
Yeah. Who else benefits from this quick return to normal?
You know, they said in the Inspector General's report in August of 2003 that the reason for that initial statement, the air is safe to breathe, was so that they could reopen Wall Street September 18th. So 1 week after 9/11, you know, the bell, stock market bell goes. And they said that was the reason. They didn't actually need to do that. It was symbolic. But certainly that takes precedence over everything else. In fact, I remember the article about the anti-nuclear activists. The government was actually quoted as saying, we are more likely to reopen an area that is economically significant to the country. In other words, if there's an environmental disaster in the middle of nowhere, they'll clean it up, but if it's in the middle of, you know, Midtown Manhattan or something like that, doesn't matter how many people live there, the economy will take precedence and they'll reopen it whether it's clean or not. So it's the opposite of what human health would dictate.
Hmm. Yeah, so it sounds like profit over people.
It does, doesn't it?
Hmm. So, I don't know, is there anything more you could say about the issue of the precedent, the implications as we move forward into this post 9/11 era in terms of how these, you know, this neglect has can contribute to more profit making at the expense of?
Okay, I mean, the only thing is they've shown their hand. It's very clear. So protect yourself accordingly. And understand that there's an ulterior motive behind what they say, and it's misleading that they call themselves the Environmental Protection Agency or anything like that. You know, it's like calling yourself the Clean Air Act. Then you can do anything as long as it has the right name.
Mm. Wow.
So I think take everything with a heavy layer of cynicism.
Indeed. I wanted to at least get one more question out to you with regard to those events, because just this past weekend there was concern about some explosions taking place in New Jersey and New York. The the New York Police Department Chief of Department Carlos Gomez was quoted as saying that we were at a level of alert that this city has never seen since 9/11. So I'm wondering if you might want to comment on if there was any resonances or personal or other impacts that, you know, from last weekend that may have taken you back to 9/11 in any way, or if that's any ill at all.
I get more nervous all the time.
Yeah.
For one reason or another. And I'm not the only one. But, these little terror attacks and the guy with the cleaver in Midtown Manhattan is, the number of them is rapidly increasing, and I watch it. If I think about it too much, you know, I can't do that.
We're speaking with Jenna Orkin. She was the co-founder of the World Trade Center Environmental Organization and other Lower Manhattan organizations uncovering and testifying to the lies of the U.S. EPA after 9/11 and the resulting compromise to the health of and lives of citizens at that time. I thought we would move our focus to another topic, since this is a 15th anniversary of 9/11, and there was a what I believe to be a giant in the field of 9/11 and 9/11 truth is Michael C. Rupert, who you became very close friends with, and I know that you recently wrote his a biography or a memoir, I guess I should call it. And I wanted to give you a chance to share a little bit about you, what you knew about Mike. And maybe we could start by just giving you a chance to talk about maybe how you first came in touch with Michael Rupert and how that friendship became forged.
Okay. On the third anniversary of the attacks, I was invited to speak on the environmental disaster at a symposium at Symphony Space on the Upper West Side. That was on September 9th. So I did my bit, and then I heard Mike. You know, I was hearing some of the other speakers, not all of them, but I did hear Mike, and I thought, oh, my God, because over the previous 3 years, I'd become steeped in government lies and the different, as we discussed, the different ways they lied and so on. And Mike brought to light a whole new dimension to that, and it clicked and it resonated. It made sense. So I went to his website and read a bunch of articles, and I thought, well, I want to be associated with these people. So I wrote an article for them about the environment, and it was the first time they'd heard about it, or some other people had heard about it. And so they published that, and then I started reading them more and providing research for them as I became versed in what kinds of issues they were pursuing and investigating. And I would send them links, and they were very interested, and I got better at it, and they got more interested. And then in 2005, I worked with Jan Lundberg to produce the first New York peak oil conference. And we invited Mike to speak, along with Jim Kunstler and the science advisor to Congressman Roscoe Bartlett and a few other people. And after that, Mike went back to California. Then in February, he asked me to take charge of a blog that was being opened at his website, fromthewilderness.com. So I said, okay. And then they sat on it for a while. By the time the blog opened, crazy stuff was happening at From the Wilderness. All seven computers had been smashed, and Mike fled to Venezuela, and I guess had something like a nervous breakdown, although one can say that he spent years in a nervous breakdown. And so then I spent quite a while talking him out of killing himself when he was in Venezuela, because he was going stir-crazy down there. Mm. Then I should say that there was one other peak oil conference in New York in April of 2006, and we met there, and then we became, I don't know, you know, dated, if you can date across the country. So by the time he was in Venezuela, we were communicating several times a day, but he was frantically in touch with everybody else, too. And he would call and tell me, sounds like a joke, but he had planned to kill himself by tying his necktie to the shower head. He was going to hang himself in his roommate's apartment. I mean, that's how nutty it was. So I was always talking him out of that. And then when he left Venezuela, he came to my apartment for 14 months. And then we spent all day, every day, with him contemplating different ways to kill himself and me making deals with him so that he wouldn't. Like, you know, I'm going out to the supermarket now. Don't kill yourself in the next 20 minutes, okay? Okay. And he considered himself a man of honor, so he didn't. Thank God he did not kill himself on my watch. So that, in brief, is our story. But the book is about the time he was in my apartment, because we had some really interesting conversations, and I wish I'd recorded more of them, but I didn't have permission in the first few weeks. Mm-hmm. And he was very fragile, so I don't have a record of that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, you did. I guess you'd only known him about 2 years until that point?
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's
so it was
right.
A very short period of time.
Right.
And I think what distinguished Mike was not only being able to provide the evidence that he presented at that 9/11 omission hearing, but that connection with peak oil. You referred to peak oil when you were talking about, like, you know, the hearings that you were organizing. And, you know, just to kind of maybe concretize that, I mean, it was this – you know, in terms of what he presented, and I mean, was it specifically that connection, the motive and the approach that that hooked you in? A unique approach, because other people have been making these, you know, speaking on the question of 9/11 and what was wrong with the official account. But he did have something of a unique approach, and there are certain lines of investigation that he chose not to pursue.
That's right. And I think he was very astute about that. The lines of investigation, as you put it, that he chose not to pursue are those that cannot be proved. In other words, you know, you can discuss ad infinitum, whether there, I don't even like to bring it up, but you can have this PhD saying that buildings can, you know, fall to the ground, can collapse with so much heat, and other PhDs saying no, they can't. And so the website, the wonderful website, oilempire.us, says for every PhD there is an equal and opposite PhD. And Mike wanted to stay out of that. He also wanted to stay out of physical evidence, because from the Kennedy assassination, he knew that physical evidence is just something for lawyers to argue about in a court of law, and you never win. So the kind of evidence which, at his best, he uncovered was from legitimate mainstream newspapers that said, for example, Osama bin Laden met with a CIA agent while he was in the hospital in Dubai. So I don't remember which it was, but Agence France-Presse or something like that. You're hard put to say, well, that's just some flaky little website. No, it's not
conjecture. You can source the...
Yeah. And so when he was at his peak, he focused on that, and that made his work very valuable. Now, he wasn't always doing that. He did make mistakes, I believe, and I told him so, and he agreed, but he couldn't help himself. I think his mistakes were in projecting into the future and saying something, you know, terrible is going to happen next week, and it wouldn't happen next week. But so we would have arguments about the calendar. Just leave the calendar out of it. And he just couldn't resist. So I think his most valuable contribution was what he uncovered about the war games on the morning of 9/11.
Yes, and that weren't mentioned in the official 9/11 Commission report, are well documented.
Yeah. At least 5 war games diverting planes from the East Coast to northern Canada and Alaska, and then such planes as remained sent out towards Russia, because we were in a Cold War mentality, they said. And one of the war games introducing 22 pieces of chaff onto the radar screen, so pilots were stymied when they wanted to go out. They didn't know, is this real, is this exercise? Things like that. Plus, one war game was a plane into a building exercise, the National Reconnaissance Office in Washington. You don't hear this stuff. You only hear about the, you know, controversial stuff.
You know, there's one aspect of Mike's biography that I really value hearing your insights about, and that's the fact of him coming from an intelligence family, an intelligence background, and having this, was it type Q clearance or something? I mean, because I'm wondering that gave him very interesting insights that whether you agree with him or not, you can't ignore what he's saying. So I'm wondering what, you know, in terms of like his... you know, how it has been, I guess you could say, both a blessing and a curse having that intelligence background in terms of what he presents and how he presents it. Is that something you think you could speak to?
I'm not a great person to speak to that, because it's, God knows, it's not a world I come from.
or myself.
Yeah, mine is quite the opposite. I mean, it was ironic, you know, his father was a war hero. My father did everything he possibly could not to go and fight people. He did serve as a hospital administrator, but very opposite families. Anyway, I believe that Mike's background gave him an understanding into how government worked and how, you know, what goes on behind the scenes is very different from what gets reported. So in that sense, I think it was a blessing. I certainly believe that with respect to his work, Mike was the right person in the right place at the right time. He was positioned, and he positioned himself to be the recipient of a lot of very interesting inside information. I mean, people would give him tips, and he knew how to use them. And so that was incomparable, what he did there. Now, in the way in which it was a curse, yeah, his family was a curse, not because of the intelligence background, but, you know, for personal reasons.
And, yes, of course, you've spoken about the suicidal ideation. Do you?
Yeah.
Yeah. I know that he did define himself as a map maker.
Right.
You know, and that was his whole approach of, you know, in order to you have to be able to contextualize events like 9/11 or you know, some of the other dramatic events and put them in that context. And so he moved there, you know, not just talking about the problems with 9/11, but also the issue of peak oil and collapse. And you seem to have very much, you know, followed in lockstep with that that whole process. And I mean, is that how you would define yourself as a map maker? I mean, I notice you have that, you're still contributing to that From the Wilderness blog in which
right.
you put up those stories. So is that?
Well, that's his phrase. Mm-hmm. And that's what he is. And I don't know what I am, but I think it's, you know, he compared himself to Galileo. They couldn't kill him because they needed his information. And that sounds kind of hubristic, but there is something to it. So, you know, if you don't lie to yourself and you look for what really drives events, yeah, it's going to lead you, you know, to an accurate, more accurate perception, whereas the rest of us might be just batted from one end to the other saying, I don't get it. What, my God, look at this, look at that. And you're looking at individual moments. He looked for the underlying primal cause of it all.
Mm-hmm.
And peak oil was that. And that. You know, peak oil is misunderstood now because the prices have been going down. What people don't ever get through their heads is that peak oil really was not predicting the end of oil. It was predicting the end of cheap oil, cheap, easy oil, and that's indisputable. That's why we have fracking, because the cheap, easy stuff is gone, and they have to resort to complex tertiary methods, which are, you know, maybe the price in money is low, but the price to the earth is exorbitant.
Well, I know that he certainly is, including and especially toward the end, he'd emphasize the issue of energy return on energy investment, you know. And so you could have a lot of energy typically in a given well, but if it takes more energy to get it out of there, it's dead.
That's right. That's exactly what that means. And you're quite right. People are unaware of that critical ratio, the EROEI, and that peak oil, When Saudi Arabia was at its peak, it could give you 30 barrels for every one invested, and sometimes much higher than that, like even 100 to 1. But 30 to 1 was pretty typical. Well, Saudi Arabia's past its peak. When Saudi Arabia tells you we're looking into renewables and, solar energy, that tells you a lot because, the oil price was... The oil market was very good to them.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know that you're getting toward the end of our time, but I noticed like another big issue for him and an issue for you, if certainly your writings have any and organizing has anything to say about, is the issue of global collapse, a very daunting subject for most of us to wrap our heads around, if we're wrapping our heads around it at all, and what that actually means. And it seems as if, you know, I mean, like, to what extent is that the prospect of collapse something that may have figured into his, apparently the despair that appears to have consumed and claimed him?
That's an intricate question. The movie that was made about him and with him called Collapse is a study both in global collapse and in Mike's collapse. And I believe that he was particularly sensitive to global collapse because his own personal experience mirrored it. And sometimes it was hard to know when he was telling you he was going to collapse next week. I think he would have told you it was the world or Ukraine or something. But in fact, it was he who was falling apart. Doesn't mean the world is not falling apart, but certainly not in the cataclysmic, immediate, instantaneous way that he was predicting. It took ancient Rome, 200 years to collapse. I don't know how this will play out. I can't begin to speculate on that. But we see it is playing out.
We see. I wanted to put one more question to you, if I could, with regard to Mike. And I didn't actually field this to you beforehand, so I hope you'll forgive me. But this idea of, I mean, it seems to me like people talking about Mike after the fact, like people didn't know him the way you did. Maybe people over-romanticizing him on the one hand, and people who are, a little bit exaggerated in their criticism of him. Do you have any, when you hear people talking about Mike, how people who didn't know him except for, in a kind of secondary way, reading his work and seeing his videos and so on, how do you find yourself responding to some of the ways people are remarking on his legacy?
I have some sympathy for it, for both sets of people that you're discussing. I know, and those of us who were close to him knew how maddening he could be. He really could be impossible. He did think that the people who smashed his computers in the end might not have been the government, they might have been disgruntled employees. Boy, did I understand where they were coming from, if it was indeed they. So I understood the negative, although I think some of those people are, a lot of those people are trolls and agents and saboteurs and everything. And I understand the people who romanticized him, which is unfortunate for them because, and that's really one of the motives I had in writing that book, especially so fast, because I wanted to reassure them that he, get real. He was not that angel. And he did not die to save the earth, as one of his final notes said. Perhaps my my death can do something to heal the earth. Well, it didn't do anything to heal the earth or any person on the earth, nor should it have. So those who felt that he was making a kind of a Christ figure of himself need to, I think, would benefit from some of the reality. And the other people, the ones who are negative, are never going to listen, so I give up on them.
Jenna Orkin, I've really appreciated this conversation.
Me too.
I'm glad to hear that. I'll just remind our audiences that you are the author of Scout, a memoir of investigative journalist Michael C. Rupert, as well as The Moron's Guide to Global Collapse. You were one of the writers on the From the Wilderness website, fromthewilderness.com, which is still accessible. And that was, of course, Mike Rupert's newsletter. Jenna Orkin, thank you for your time.
Thanks, Michael.
Okay, we've been speaking with Jenna Orkin, co-founder of the World Trade Center Environmental Organization and of other Lower Manhattan organizations, uncovering and testifying to the lies of the U.S. EPA following 9/11.
You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.